7. So, Governor Stanton, Don O'Brien asked in his thick, caramel voice, can I offer you a hop?
A Diet Coke, Stanton said, if you got any.
I was back at the beginning of time. Senator O'Brien raised himself, massive, ursin, from behind his walnut and brass desk, and went to the doorless closet where he kept the small refrigerator. The little office was dark and den-like. There were soft lights, heavy gold curtains, no views. O'Brien, uncomfortable in large and light places, had given his formal office over to staff and hidden himself in a support room beyond. There was the desk, which took up about a third of the room. Stanton and I in two chairs facing the desk. Dov Mandelbaum, the senator's young strategist, my former counterpart, sat behind us on the small sofa along the back wall. On the walls were photos of Don O'Brien with every president since Eisenhower and three others. A laminated cover of Time magazine from some time in the early 70s, featuring a Don O'Brien who looked very much as he did today. White hair, huge red face, bulbous nose and thick lips, but with longer sideburns, is one occasion to that inelegant moment in time. There was also a photo of Senator O'Brien, the son of a Southie garbage hauler, receiving his honorary degree from the Havids. And dominating the room, above the sofa where Dove sat, was a portrait of the senator's deceased wife, Fiona, smiling, head tilted slightly, an overpowering kindness emanating from her eyes. Don O'Brien spent every day staring directly at that portrait.
So what can I do for you, Governor Stanton? Donnie asked, returning to his seat with a Diet Coke for Stanton and a cup of tea for himself.
I want to ask you for your support.
Don O'Brien threw back his head and roared appreciatively. It was a reference to the senator's favorite political story, how he'd come home from his first losing congressional campaign and thanked his neighbor, Mrs. Aggie Murphy, for her support, and she'd said, but Donnie, I didn't vote for you. O'Brien, crushed, reminded her that he'd gone to the store for her and shoveled her walk free of charge for 20 years. So why on earth wouldn't she vote for him? Because you didn't ask, she said, or so he claimed. Stanton, of course, realized that O'Brien's support would not be forthcoming that day. Dov and I had negotiated the logistics of this meeting carefully. There would be no statement of support, no photo op, but Donnie had agreed to meet with us, which seemed a victory. It meant that Larkin would have to meet with us as well, which was, I was certain, Donnie's primary motive. He lived for Lark's discomfort.
Jack, I've been watching you, O'Brien now said warmly, and you puzzle me. I watch you on Sunday nights on C-SPAN. Road to the White House. It's taken the place of Ed Sullivan in my life. It's quite amazing. They'll show you or Larry or Bart or that pipsqueak Charlie Martin just shaking hands for a half hour. Can you imagine? Who'd ever want to watch such a thing? Except for the likes of us, of course. So we have our own private network now. He smiled, shaking his head, looking up at Fiona. Only not so private. Not much we can get away with in private anymore, huh, Jack?
O'Brien sipped his tea, leaned forward, elbows on the desk.
Anyway, here's what puzzles me about you. You are very good at this. That is abundantly clear. The thing that makes you so good is you really do like them, the folks, don't you? You seem to enjoy yourself with them. That's important. They'll cut you some slack if they think you like them. You give a nice speech, too. But I have never seen a politician carry so much trouble around with him. You're like that cartoon character. What's his name, Dove?
Pigpen.
O'Brien chuckled. Pigpen. Permanent cloud of dirt follows him around. It worries me, Jack. A cloud like that doesn't happen by accident. I know this latest thing, Larry's coronary, isn't really your fault. Though the way they keep playing the Izzy, whatchamacallit, tape on the news over and over doesn't help any. And I know that it's not the way it used to be. Everyone gets taken apart these days. We all suffer. They have an 18-minute report on Eye to Eye, or whatever they call that show, about me playing golf in the Bahamas with the insurance industry. It doesn't look good. So there's no such thing as security anymore.
No more safe seats. It's hard for us to legislate confidently if we're all walking on tiptoe, if you know what I mean. Everyone feels the heat. But what I wonder about you is, do you need the heat? Are you one of those boyos who like danger? A skydiver, or...
Stanton started to respond, but stopped, intelligently, realizing there was nothing to be said here.
The other Jack, Kennedy, he was like that,
O'Brien continued.
A perfect skydiver. He was like one of those Greek heroes who forgets he isn't a god. He was a Mick who forgot he wasn't a wasp. It's okay for the gods to live dangerously. They can come down, rape and pillage, run off with our daughters, turn our sons into sparrows. But if a man mistakes himself for a god, they will find a way to humiliate you. They will have their revenge. Discipline is how we show them reverence. But you, Jack, seem to enjoy tempting them.
I've made mistakes, Stanton said.
Perhaps one too many, O'Brien said.
Perhaps, the governor said.
But I've learned from them, and I've survived. You may not be thrilled by it, but I'm still here, and I'm not going away. If someone wants this nomination, they will have to come in and take it from me.
A big if, O'Brien said. You've driven the stock down, unfortunately. There may be no takers. Not from here, anyway.
Larkin, I can tell you what he's thinking. He has made his calculations. It's too late for him to get into many of the primaries. A couple, maybe.
California, Dove said. He won't come in just for California, O'Brien said.
He is a cautious man, right, Henry?
He'd want to test his act on a smaller stage first. He likes sure things. Henry used to be his balls. He looked over at me, curious.
This fella doesn't need those, he said, nodding to Stanton.
So what are you giving him? You loaning him your conscience, Henry?
Stanton shifted in his seat, but stayed calm.
You know, Jack, I don't know if William Larkin would take the nomination if we handed it to him at this point, O'Brien said. The president is likely to be reelected, whoever runs against him.
That would leave Bill looking to be a university president next December. Lousy work. More fundraising than here, and you don't get to cut deals.
O'Brien looked for a laugh. Stanton obliged with a chuckle. Donnie wrinkled his brow, tossed a dismissive hand.
Nah, the Lark won't take that chance.
He's been here. How long, Henry? 20 years? Made an elegant move to the leadership. Took you by surprise, didn't it? He said to me again.
Anyway, we've all been living with Republican presidents for a long time. Some real stinkers, too. Another 4 years if it won't kill us.
But we don't want to be embarrassed, either, if you know what I mean, Jack. You make a fool of this party, we could lose some seats in November. Might even lose the Senate again. I wouldn't be pleased by that. Have to move all my stuff across the hall.
O'Brien leaned back in his chair, stared up at Fiona. He had said his piece.
I can win the nomination and beat the president, Stanton said forcefully.
I've been hoping for something more puckish, more clever. Donnie was testing him now. But the governor had decided not to take any chances. His toughness was an issue, and he would play this as tough as he could.
O'Brien laughed.
Dove, incumbent presidents beaten this century?
Taft, Hoover, Carter.
Beaten by Wilson, Roosevelt, and Reagan, O'Brien said.
So are you telling me, Jack, that the incumbent is in a class with the former, and you are in a class with the latter?
He laughed again and shook his head.
Tell me another one.
If not Larkin, who'll take it from me? Stanton said.
I don't know, O'Brien said. But we can always work out something respectable.
And we will if you don't pull this together. I can promise you that. If you come out of California with one delegate less than a majority, you will find yourself back in Mammoth Falls, cutting ribbons and distributing highway contracts by the end of July.
And if I do pull it together?
I will admire your perseverance, O'Brien said.
In fact, I already admire your perseverance. There are worse qualities a politician can have.
If I pull it together, Stanton asked, will you place my name in nomination?
Not very smart politics, Governor. An old fart like me doing that? I play golf with the insurance industry,
A sin apparently even more troublesome to Americans than diddling a hairdresser, if that's what you did.
No, I won't place your name in nomination, Jack, O'Brien said, rising, ending it. But I will do what I didn't do today. I will stand on the steps outside with you and have my picture taken.
Which was about as good as it got that week. Not bad, in fact. O'Brien's was an entirely reasonable position. Few others were ready to give us that much. The meeting with Larkin, which followed immediately, a cloud of scorps trailing us from one end of the Capitol to the other, was surreal by comparison. The Lark would not deign to discuss politics with Stanton. He reminisced about the last time he and Marianne had had dinner with Jack and Susan. He asked about young Jackie. He talked about his own kids. He became passionate and very detailed about the intransigence of the Japanese in trade negotiations. Stanton showed him he could be equally passionate and even more detailed on the same subject, and in the process, sent the message that if Larkin wanted to challenge him, he would give no quarter. I thought it was an impressive performance. Larkin looked over at me from time to time, coolly, not unpleasantly, bland lashless eyes unblinking. I unblinked back at him. Stanton walked out of there furious, disdainful.
God, please, I want that gelding, he whispered.
We gave the press some time then, in the statuary hall outside the chamber house. We couldn't not.
Governor Stanton, what, if anything, do you think you accomplished here today?
A mousy woman from AP asked.
I had a chance to sit down with our congressional leaders and get to know each other better, he said casually.
Did either of them ask you to withdraw?
Absolutely not.
Have you read A.P. Colley's piece in the Times? Do you have a reaction?
Colley, who always tapped the purest, if not quite the freshest, vein of conventional wisdom in Washington, had called three former Democratic Party chairs who expressed alarm, though not directly for attribution, that a man of Jack Stanton's character seemed destined to win the nomination.
No, Stanton lied. What's he say?
Well, that a lot of leading Democrats think you don't have the character to be president.
Well, look, he said, I'm mostly interested in what the people think. If they think I should go home, my guess is they'll figure out a way to get the message across.
Will Bill Larkin challenge you?
You'll have to ask him that. Fine with we if he does. Our party should have its strongest possible candidate next fall. Any of these folks can prove they're stronger than me, I'll support them.
Have you talked yet with Mrs. Harris?
A young woman from the Boston Globe asked.
Have you apologized?
For what?
Stanton glared at her. It was a smart, controlled flash of anger. None of the other reporters would have the guts to say,
for baiting him into a massive heart attack.
Look, we have a serious situation here, Stanton said, turning instantaneously sober. I have suspended campaigning. I know it's hard, but maybe we should all show a little restraint for the next few days. Till we know more about Senator Harris's condition. Thanks.
That day in Washington, the Friday after the Florida primary, was strange and remarkable in many ways, but truly memorable in only one. It was the first time I ever saw Daisy in a skirt. It was a kilt, to be precise, of a heathery plaid, and much shorter than the kilts I remembered from school. She was also wearing a black blazer, a sky-blue turtleneck, dangling enamel earrings, black stockings, and heels. She looked spectacular. We met at a restaurant near the White House that was deep in mortal trendiness at the moment, offering Washington its first haute, high-concept, hyper-designed, if not quite distinguished, Tex-Mex cuisine.
My God, look at you, I said. I was standing at the bar watching the door. I hadn't recognized her at first.
Do you do this often?
Get dressed? She asked. Only when I'm depressed. It's okay?
It's fabulous, I said.
You're depressed?
Aren't you?
She snaked an arm around my waist and whispered in my ear, Let's drink margaritas, go home and get laid.
Sounds good to me, I said.
But something was up. She was pressing. Here comes Richard.
It took him a while to reach us. This was Washington. Everyone knew Richard. Knew all of us, more or less. And he took his time, working his way along the bar, shaking hands, slapping backs, and chatting.
his honks and bleats overwhelming even this incredibly noisy restaurant. Unlike Daisy, Richard looked the same here as in America. Blue blazer, white shirt, no tie, and his signature pressed, too tight, too short jeans, and white socks and running shoes. "Assholes in mega vulture mode tonight, you know what I mean?" he greeted us. "Let's get a table."
"Smoking okay?" Daisy said.
"Swear, Daisy May, I always forget you smoke. I used to smoke, you know that?"
"I'll bet you did," she said,
as we were led to a corner table in a nearly depopulated room. "Never underestimate the pariah factor. Smoking will get you a quiet table, and fast, too."
"You know how I stopped?" Richard said. "I smoked 200 cigarettes, 10 packs in a single day. I decided to gorge myself on them, you know what I mean? My throat was killing me. I thought I was going to die by lunchtime. So you know what I did? I switched to Lucky's, then to Paul fucking Mall, the strongest, harshest, worst damn things I could find. It was the most disgusting thing I ever did that didn't involve sex or politics. By nightfall, I needed an iron lung. I needed to be fumigated or sterilized or some fucking thing. I surrounded myself with ashtrays full of these stale, disgusting pieces of shit. Put them all around my bed that night. Next morning, I woke up, blew lunch, could hardly talk. My throat was killing me so much, and I never touched another damn one of those things again. You should try it, Daze."
"I don't think so," she said. "I only smoke 4 or 5 a day. No big deal. Reminds my friends I'm not an absolutely perfect person, right, Henry?"
"That and your taste in movies," I said.
"So," she said, "tell us."
"Boy, it is weird being back here doing the same old shit," I said. "Being a supplicant in Donnie O'Brien's office, feeling the lark's cool breeze, seeing all these tactical people reminds me of why I left town."
"But you love it, too," Daisy said. "Always the unambiguous junkie, but a little worried now that I might not be."
"It's what you do."
"It's what I did," I said. "You know, I can't remember the last time I was here, but it didn't take a nanosecond to remember the feel of the place. Everybody's so on top of everything. The guy at the dry cleaners has an opinion about the emissions trading provisions of the Clean Air Act. The Ethiopian cabbie wants to know if Donnie's going to block cloture on capital gains. It's like being trapped inside talk radio, a city full of crank callers with nothing else in their lives, nothing better to do. It's why the rest of the country thinks we're nuts."
"Blah, blah, blah," Richard said appropriately.
Trashing Washington is one of the world's most gratuitous pastimes.
"What happened up on the hill today? And where's the waitress? Or is this place too trendy to have help? Hey, you!"
A very hip young woman wearing black lipstick and black combat boots ambled over. We ordered drinks. Daisy had a frozen margarita with a double shot. I tried one, too. Richard had a Diet Coke. "It wasn't a disaster," I said, when the waitress wandered off. "The candidate was fine. I think he scared the shit out of the lark, out-talked him on Japanese trade policy. But it was just weird. I kept thinking, is this the prize? Is this what we've been running to win?"
"We win, it changes," Daisy said.
"Guys, I wouldn't go around worrying too damn much about winning this week," Richard said. "You hear what Marshall Gordon's going to say on Sunday? We should step aside because of all the shit that's gone down."
Marshall Gordon, who'd been writing a column in the Post since before forever, was the unimpeachable voice of moderate sanity in Washington.
"Step aside for what?" Daisy asked.
"For the wise men to uncork the magic bottle at the convention," Richard said, shimmering his hands like a hoodoo man. "All them geniuses who've been doing so well by the party, doing well by doing good, you know what I mean? They're going to haul their $2,000 suits into a room and restore sanity to the process."
He flipped a bird then.
"Fuck them. And then, when it happens, when they've picked the Pope and Vice Pope, they'll leak it to old Marshall Gordon. Sure beats having an election. It's this week's parlor game. What's the real ticket? Who's in the room when it gets decided?"
"My guess," Daisy said, "is their guess is something like Ozzie O'Loughlin, right? The real question is, which of us winds up on the Today Show Monday morning to respond to Gordon's column? I said, not wanting to play the what-if game. Who goes on Nightline Monday night? Why is it that every other week we've got a new mini-wave of crap to wade through? Send Libby, Daisy said. Fuck 'em all. Fuck 'em all is right, I said. This is bullshit. No one's gonna do anything. No one's gonna come out and stop us. You could see Jack sense that today. He paid his respects and was tough as nails. You sit in the same room as him and the Lark. You realize what a flimsy contraption the Lark is. He'd get blown away if he ever actually walked out into the street and came after us. These guys are moles. They live in that building. They go rummaging around after each other through piles of mole shit. They don't do sunlight. Don't have much sunlight right now, Henri, Richard said as the drinks came. He took one long, nearly obscene gulp and said to the waitress, Honey, you think you could bestir yourself to bring me another? He smiled at her sneer, then turned back to us. Check it out. We're stacked up in the clouds, circling the runway. We're all sitting around scratching our balls. Mixed metaphor alert, Daisy said. Well, shit, Daisy May, Richard said. They are having fucking elections in Michigan and Illinois. Got more delegates coming out of Chicago than we spent a year driving ourselves crazy over in New Hampshire. And we're not out there working it. No one is. You ask me, should we just fuck all this humble, respectful shit and send him out? Do some town meetings? Win those suckers? Shut these assholes up? He won't do it, I said. Not yet. He better soon, Richard said. It's America. It may not be the brandy and bullshit crowd, but someone's gonna come after us. It's driving me nuts trying to figure out who. I checked down the road, see whether Charlie Martin could get back in, or even Nielsen. He won't, I said. He's with us. When's the last time you saw him around? Richard said, stopping me. Richard, as usual, was thinking through worst-case scenarios, all of which had come true so far, though that hadn't done us much good in preparing for them. Henri, use your fucking head. Someone is gonna come after us. We're heading to New York. Ozio. Could Ozio use Harris's line? You know, drop a hint. If you vote for the vegetable, you can still stop Stanton. Ozio could still get in on California, though he's gonna have to move his butt. He won't, Daisy said. He'll do some body language. He'll do what he can to fuck with us in New York. But he's not gonna make an overt move. Overt isn't in his racial memory. Someone is coming after us, Richard said. Then began to peruse the menu. What is this? One of these places where you can build your own pineapple guacamole chimichanga? Everything about sex is banal except the anticipation. The act itself, though undeniably satisfying, is memorable no more than a handful of times in the course of a life. And imperfect, more often than not. I can remember every twitch, glance, touch, hint, the way my hair felt the afternoon Daisy and I first made love in Mammoth Falls. With Susan Stanton, though, there had been no anticipation, no expectation. Okay, a stray thought occasionally, but she was Susan Stanton, the world's most fortified bunker. It wasn't anything you could think about in broad daylight. But it happened. It happened in a semi-numb realm of physical experience, a reflexive part of the brain and body. It happened too quickly to engage the imagination. She even smelled distant and formal, all soap and hairspray. I'd never, I realized, made love before to a woman who used hairspray. It made her hair feel stiff, and it preoccupied me. I found myself thinking about the stiffness of her hair rather than what our bodies were doing. When her body finished what it was doing, she made a barely audible grunt, a door closing. She gathered her clothes in the dark. She didn't say anything or do anything, or touch me or kiss me goodbye. I saw her silhouette as she moved brusquely through the amber crime light crack between the curtains of my hotel room. That was all I saw. She didn't call the next day or the days after, which was relief, but a tiny, guilty disappointment, too. Sometimes even the anticipation is banal. My reaction to Daisy that night was entirely predictable, straight out of the Wear Something Different chapter of How to Please a Man. I was crazed horny. My hand was up under that little kilt as soon as we jumped into a cab. I was moving on her as soon as she opened the door to her house. She had a bandbox row house on Capitol Hill, a tiny Washington place. She turned on the lights. I turned them off.
Henry, a skirt will do this to you?
She turned on the lights again, a row of track lights along the right wall. Don't you even want to look around? See who I am?
I know who you are. You're smart and honest and orderly. You have a bookcase filled with politics and thrillers. You have...
What's this? I started to laugh. She had a vertical display rack, the sort of thing you'd see in a poster store, with an array of old movie posters hanging on the wall to the left of the bookcase.
I couldn't make up my mind, she said. I couldn't settle on just one movie. You walk in and see The Sands of Iwo Jima or Casablanca and say, oh, she's one of those.
Of course, if you pinned me up against the wall and said, choose one, I'd have to go with Sullivan's Travels, and I've got it right here.
She flipped to Veronica Lake and Joel McRae, eternally romantic and cool, preternaturally American.
Great movies, good choice, I said. Why not go with it?
'Cause all of these are great. I bought them. I paid good money for them. They are originals. I wanted to be able to see them all. So what would your choice be, Henry? Rashomon?
She said this with a tinge of something in her voice. I ignored it.
She let me ignore it until after we made love upstairs in her bedroom with the four televisions. I didn't notice the televisions until afterwards, which said something about my state of mind and the intensity of my anticipation that night. I liked the bedroom, despite the televisions. She had it painted a dark Chinese red. There were four gold-framed Thomas Nast drawings on the wall. The bed was queen-size, with crisp, cherry blue and white checkered sheets and pillowcases beneath a navy comforter. The lighting was soft, although there was a gooseneck brass reading lamp that arced in from the right side of the bed. I hadn't asked her about it, but I realized that she'd never lived with a man in that house.
See, this is different from campaign sex, she said when I'd subsided. There is a campaign going on out there somewhere, but we're not part of it right now.
And?
Not fucking bad at all, she said, nuzzling her nose in my ear. But that wasn't quite true. I had sensed her holding back, bemused by my enthusiasm, perhaps, or maybe something else.
You want anything from downstairs? A Diet Coke?
She returned wearing a mohair shawl and nothing else. She tossed me the soda. It was strange, her casual nakedness, a new level of intimacy for us. We were always working our way through new levels, slowly and carefully, one at a time. We hadn't reached one yet we couldn't handle.
So, why didn't you tell me about the McAllister girl? She asked, trying to sound offhand.
He told me not to tell anyone. He specifically mentioned you. I guess he figured that if you knew, Susan would.
She nodded. She didn't say anything.
Look, I said, but couldn't figure out what to say next.
So you went and scared Fat Willie into having his daughter get an amniocentesis. I don't get it.
He figured Howard would scare her out of getting an amniocentesis, and that would make it go away.
Brilliant, Daisy said.
He didn't understand that Fat Willie would do whatever his friend the governor asked.
So she went? I asked.
You haven't been following this step by step? She asked. It's your baby, as it were.
Willie came to me, I said.
So that makes it
horrendous.
You think I enjoyed it? I didn't want any part of it. I didn't want to think about it. I didn't think about it. I didn't even know she'd gone for the amnio.
It was a late amnio, real late, she said. It was too late to do a chorionic villus sampling. CVS, it's the latest thing, through the vagina, not the abdomen. They take pre-placental material. Might have been a little easier on the kid, but she's got herself a placenta now, feeding little Jackie McAllister or whoever it is. Anyway, we'll have a result in a couple of weeks.
How do you know all this?
Susan put Libby on the case. She's practically moved in with the McAllisters.
Of course, I said. Look,
That day with Howard, it was the worst thing I've ever done.
But you did it.
He insisted it wasn't his baby.
And you believed him?
An important moment for us, Daisy and me.
Not entirely, I said.
If I'd believed him entirely, it would have merely been awful, not the complete fucking horror that it has been. He did volunteer to have his blood taken, so I had to figure he was in the clear. And you know how dangerous it is to have something like this floating out there? The girl could tell a friend, the friend could tell another, and he could be absolutely innocent, and the whole campaign could come down. You think we could handle another scandal? Fuck, not even a scandal. You think we could handle another denial? But still, there was, is, something bugging me about this. Something in my gut. I don't believe he's absolutely innocent, you know? And even if he is in this case, I realize that I wouldn't put it past him, taking advantage of that girl. And you can't imagine how ashamed I was. Howard did the heavy lifting, and a cold son of a bitch he was. But I was complicit. Willie came to me. He trusted me. And I guess what it was I had to give the governor the benefit of the doubt. I mean, if it's true that it's not his baby, then this had to be done, right? And what will you think of him if it does turn out to be his baby?
I don't know. A lot less, I imagine.
Daisy, I sat up. I don't understand how I think about this. I don't have a fucking clue. It's like compartmentalizing. There's the politician, the guy we've all invested in, and then there's this. How do you think about it?
I haven't until recently, obviously, she said. And then I was pissed.
At him?
At you!
I'm sorry, I said. But I found myself wondering. Was she pissed because I hadn't told her? Because she hadn't been able to sense there was something important I wasn't telling her. The latter, I realized, was potentially more threatening. It meant that there were things she might never know about me, ways she couldn't trust me, ways I could hurt her. She was crying quietly. I put my arm around her and pulled her toward me. She resisted, but she came. We won Illinois and Michigan, but no one noticed. We hardly noticed. Other things happened that day. In Fort Lauderdale, Martha Harris, a sturdy cranberry oat brand muffin of a woman, held a press conference at the hospital where her husband remained in a coma. I was back in Mammoth Falls at our headquarters. All activity stopped when Mrs. Harris came on the screen. She had the Stanton campaign's undivided attention. First of all, I want to thank the American public, all of you, for your remarkable outpouring of affection, she said. I would especially like to thank the children of America. My husband, Senator Harris, was doing this for you, and clearly you understood that. The letters and drawings and everything we've gotten during the past week, I've read some of them to my husband. I think he can hear you. Her voice broke now. And I'm sure he is, as I am now, more hopeful than ever about the future of our country. But hope is not enough. We need to do more. And I thought about Richard. Right again. Here they come. A great many of you have written asking us how we might keep the Harris movement alive, she said. I think it's obvious at this point that my husband will not be able to continue his campaign for the presidency, but someone should. And so I have asked former Governor Fred Picker of Florida, and he has agreed to carry on for us to continue to raise the issues. And now Freddie Picker moved somberly into the frame, head slightly bowed, hands clasped together in front of him. He was, finally, wearing a tie. Blue and gold striped, it appeared. And carry our message, Martha Harris continued, all the way to the convention and beyond, if possible. Both Lawrence and I learned to love Freddie Picker over the years, and especially over the past few weeks. He has been a devoted friend. He knows the meaning of honor. He understands what this country needs, and he will continue what we have begun in an honorable way. And now, she said, tears suddenly spurting from both her eyes, let me turn this campaign over to Governor Picker. He was crying too. He brushed a tear from his right eye with the back of his hand, kissed Martha Harris lightly on the cheek, took a deep breath, stared down as if in prayer, then looked up, his fierce eyes quiet. Different. There was a scattering of applause in the room. CNN had only one camera on the scene, so it was hard to tell how many people and reporters were there, but it seemed pretty cramped.
I hope you'll excuse me, he said. This is a very emotional time. I have a brief statement and then I'll take a few questions, a very few, because, quite honestly, I haven't thought this through yet. Mrs. Harris approached me with this idea only yesterday. I was honored. I felt I couldn't possibly say no.
He was staring directly into the CNN camera. I thought about the logistics of this. There were probably 10 cameras facing him. And he made sure to find the one that was broadcasting this live, nationally.
And I will try my darndest to express the themes that Lawrence Harris has begun to lay out for the American people in a manner consistent with the spirit of his campaign. Today I've spoken with several of our party leaders and told them what Mrs. Harris has asked me to do.
Have you spoken with Governor Stanton? A reporter interrupted.
No, he said. But let me make this clear. I am not running against Jack Stanton. I am running for Lawrence Harris.
Does that mean you agree with every position he has taken in this campaign?
Most everything, he said. There may be some differences in personal style, differences in emphasis, but I think Senator Harris was doing something important and challenging in this campaign, and I intend to carry that forward.
Do you think you can win the nomination?
I'm not trying to win the nomination. I'm just trying to continue what Senator Harris began, trying to give the American people an honest choice.
But if you won the nomination,
it would be premature for me to discuss that, since I haven't given it a moment's thought. And that's why I think it'd be best to cut this session off right here. I've spent the night thinking about how I wanted to start this thing, he said, talking to CNN again, about what gesture might convey the immense respect I have for Senator Harris, and the humility I feel at this moment, and the need for all of us to pull together as a country and give of ourselves. So I decided, since we're here in the hospital, that I'd just go down and donate a pint of blood.
There was a groan in Stanton headquarters, which had been stone silent to that point. And I must admit, I was shaking my head too, and sort of half wondering who'd buzz me first, Richard, Daisy, or the governor. It was the governor.
Jesus Christ, Henry. We should have thought of that, he said. The blood thing.
We had a conference call that afternoon. It was a cumbersome thing. The governor and Susan at the mansion, Howard, Lucille, and me at headquarters, Richard, Leon, and Daisy in Washington.
All right, Stanton said. What now?
Silence.
Good thing I've got all you geniuses on board, he said.
Okay, I'll go first. We start campaigning again immediately. Connecticut and New York. Howard, I want to see a New York schedule and strategy this time tomorrow. Beyond that, I'm stumped. How do we treat this guy? Do we ignore him, debate him, treat him like a candidate? I assume Harris has a ballot line in every state. Does he have full slates?
He's had some trouble slating. As for ballot lines, we could have knocked him off in New York, Howard said. But you don't want that.
Right, Stanton said. And one thing is absolutely certain at this point. We're not going to do anything that smacks of politics. We're going to get the League of Women Voters' seal of approval for every last fucking thing we do. We're going to be more high-minded than public television. But within those parameters, we got to be smart. Richard, how do we run against this guy without running against him?
Well, first thing, Richard said, you gotta expect he's gonna be the flavor of the week. And it's all gonna be golden. The TV stuff, the profiles, he'll be interviewed everywhere the next few days. We're gonna have to be patient and see what he does.
Any guesses? Silence, then Daisy.
Well, obviously, we have no idea how he's gonna campaign, how he's gonna look. But my gut says he's gonna jettison a lot of Harris's excess baggage. He can't junk the virgin uses tax, but he can slim it down, de-emphasize it some. Same with Social Security COLA. He seems smart. He may be tougher for us than Harris.
What do we know about him? Susan asked. Where's his family? Why'd he quit being governor? Where's he been all our lives?
He's divorced, isn't he?
Richard said. The point is, we don't know, Susan said. We're going to need Libby to do a nexus.
Meanwhile, Stanton asked, what do I say tonight? After I thank the people of Illinois and Michigan for this victory no one is going to care about. No, wait a minute. I've got a better question. Howard, can he stop us? Let's assume the party takes the Donnie O'Brien position. I get no help from them. We've got to make 50% plus one on our own. Can he stop us?
Yes, Howard said.
Easily?
Yes.
Don't we have 1,000-some-odd delegates already?
We're running about 55%, depending on how we do tonight, Howard said. If we keep running at that rate, we're okay, by a little, even assuming most of the superdelegates hang back and take their sweet time making up their minds. We've got commitments from about 250 of the 768 super-Ds now, mostly the ones from down here, though who knows how solid they are.
Howard, we damn well better find out, Stanton said. I want a list of names. No, I want to know every damn thing about every last one of them. What they want, what they need. I want you to set up a super D squad, keep track of them, figure out ways to put me in touch with them, and I want to talk to each one of them in the next month. And I also want the word to go out, these 768 superdelegates are family now. You treat them like mama. They say fetch, you go fetch, you hear? Now, Howard, why is it you think we're in such deep shit?
Well, Howard said.
Well, what?
It's just, I know New York, Howard said. Everything is driven by the tabloids there. The TVs make their news decisions off the tabs. So Kashmir was a bigger story than in most places. The Izzy Rosenblatt got played like a mafia hit. I would guess we'd have a struggle on our hands there against anyone. And if we start losing primaries, all bets are obviously off.
Leon, do we have New York numbers? Susan asked.
I don't, he said. But the Marist poll has you at 22 with 50% or so undecided.
And the rest?
Harris was running at 18% comatose, pre-picker.
Sweet Jesus, Stanton said.
So what do I say tonight?
Again, silence, then Daisy.
One thing is, you've got to be prepared for questions about Picker giving blood today.
Why? Stanton exploded. What on earth do I say about that?
Well, it was his big moment today. It's a great gimmick. You got to figure it's going to be an issue. You're going to be asked about it. You're going to be asked when the last time you gave blood was.
She hadn't realized what she was saying until halfway through the sentence. There was a stony silence in the ether. Stanton, Susan, Howard, Daisy, and I all knew when and why Jack Stanton had last given blood.
Maybe you should go down to Mercy and give a pint tomorrow, Susan said, saving us all from the silence.
It'll seem copycat, cheap, Lucille said.
Better cheap than have a bunch of scorps all over us asking whether or not you're going to match Picker's pint, and if not, why not?
Richard said.
What makes you think they'll be all over us? Lucille asked. Reporters are cynics. They'll see the blood-giving for the cheap stunt it was. You don't want to look like you're panicking over this guy.
Well, aren't we? Stanton asked.
I called Daisy after Nightline. Various Washington talking heads had predicted that Freddie Picker was just a stalking horse for Larkin or Ozzio. Jeff Greenfield did the lead piece, which was filled with wonderful file footage. Picker, with long sideburns, wearing what looked like a tangerine leisure suit, brandishing a broom over his head as he ran for governor in 1974. There was also footage of the strange press conference when he dropped out 4 years later.
I thought I was going to announce I was running for a re-election, but I changed my mind, he said, eyes shifting about, bleary, nervous.
Greenfield said that Picker's action had never really been explained, that he had lived quietly on a plantation just north of Tallahassee ever since, sharing custody of his two sons with his former wife, Antonia Reyes Cardinale,
the daughter of a prominent Cuban emigre businessman. They had divorced soon after he left office. There are always suspicions raised when a politician leaves office abruptly, Greenfield concluded. No doubt, former Governor Picker will have to deal with them in the days to come. For tonight, though, Freddie Picker must be considered a significant and formidable new force in what has become an entirely bizarre presidential campaign.
And I've got to say, Ted, that pint of blood was the first tangible thing we've gotten from any of these candidates this year.
Daisy was a mess.
I am a complete fucking nincompoop, she said. Henry, I swear to God, I didn't realize what I was saying until I was halfway through the sentence. You think I'm dead?
I thought she had hurt herself, but I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what she wanted, to be soothed or to be told the truth.
You're as alive as anyone I know, I said, not very convincingly, and pissed at myself for being so awkward, so reticent, so sappy. More alive than most.
Henry. Yeah, okay. The truth is, I don't know. You can't tell with them. It sounded the way you said it happened, that you didn't realize it until halfway through. It was the hesitation that hurt.
And then the silence, she said. Conference calls are so fucking weird. It's like you're having a meeting in a cave.
Look, Daisy, I said, I can't tell you don't kill yourself over this because I know you're killing yourself over this. But you've done great stuff for this campaign. The Stantons know that, and they're gonna need all the help they can get now.
I am a fucking idiot, she said. I feel all,
she was about to say, alone.
Don't, I said. I'm here. You're there, she said, down in the darkness surrounded by the great books with the river flowing outside your window.
Her voice broke.
I need you here.
We'll be together in New York by the end of the week, I said.
Looks like we'll be there for a while, too.
That means the ultimate horror. Proximity to Mom, she said.
Henry, I'm gonna ask you a favor. An enormous, humongous, completely out-of-bounds favor. Will you let me take you home, have dinner with my mom?
Sure, I said. Why not?
You'll see, she said.
And you've also got the promise that nothing said or done or implied by my mother will affect your feelings toward me, okay?
I laughed.
Daisy, I said, don't worry about it tonight, okay?
Oh, sure, she said. You know I won't.
Henry, look. I promised myself I wouldn't start saying anything or even thinking it until the campaign was over and we were, like, sane again, you know? But there is something happening here with us, isn't there? I need to know.
Yes, I said without hesitation.
And we don't have to talk about it anymore now, Henry. Or say any of the words. We can wait till this is over and we can think clearly, but I'm feeling kind of quivery and gelatinous over you.
Oh, and one other thing, she quickly added, pulling back from the brink.
Freddy's not a stalking horse for anyone. He's better than Ozzie or Larkin. And the blood thing was brilliant. You saw how Greenfield handled it. I knew Lucille had to be fucked up about the press reaction, as always. I mean, the way the guy said it, the ease, the humility. Fucking fabulous. I wonder why he quit.
So, Governor, Bryant Gumbel asked at 7:11 the next morning, why did you quit politics in 1978, and why are you back now?
The camera was too close in on Freddie Picker. He seemed squished into a corner, a leaf of the inevitable potted plant flopping over his shoulder. But he was cool. His black eyes were alive, they were naturally intense, but he could soften them to great effect, and he did so now.
Well, Bryant, I thought it was important to carry through on what Senator Harris was trying to get across, he said. And should we consider you an actual candidate for president or just a stand-in?
Well, we'll have to see about that, Picker said. For now, I just want to give the folks a choice. It's been a while since I've done this. I'm not sure I'll be any good at it.
Governor, why did you quit in 1978?
There was a lot of things, Picker said carefully. I was a lot younger man then, a lot less patient. I got frustrated with how long and hard you had to work to get anything done.
He paused for a carefully measured moment of time and then said,
and there was some personal problems.
Well,
I suppose someone's going to have to ask this question, Governor, Gumbel said, trying unsuccessfully to sound remorseful about it. What sort of personal problems?
Family problems, Picker said, then stopped. He was very disciplined. You had the sense that he was in complete control of the situation.
I know this can't be easy for you to talk about.
No, it isn't, Bryant. But I guess it's part of the game now, and so I'll be candid. In the hopes that people will respect the privacy of my former wife, who is not a public figure. He was looking straight at the camera, calm, clear-eyed. What happened was, I got too wrapped up in the business of being governor and began to neglect my family. And my wife fell in love with another man. I think I heard Gumbel gasp, or maybe it was just me. The simplicity and calm of the statement was breathtaking. I quit, in part to see if I could salvage my marriage, he continued. But I couldn't. And so I did the next best thing. I resolved to be as good a father as I could. I tried to make sure the boys knew that they had two parents who loved them. And I think if you ask them, they'll tell you that we made it through okay. They're off in college now, and they were both big Lawrence Harris supporters. And when Mrs. Harris asked me to do this, they were very enthusiastic. I guess you could say I'm doing it for them.
Awesome, Richard said. As good as I've ever seen.
What do we do? I asked.
Just stand around slack-jawed playing with ourselves and hope to fuck our eyes are deceiving us, Richard said. We're facing a tidal wave with a sump pump.
The sump pump's name was Richmond Rucker, and he was the mayor of the city of New York. He had come out of the Harlem clubhouse, a formal, distinguished-looking man with a reputation for both kindliness and modest intelligence, neither of which was deserved. He was devious smart and vicious mean. He would endorse us because he and Howard Ferguson had been close for years, and because Orlando Ozio wouldn't. Democratic governors and mayors of New York were famous for detesting each other and playing out their enmities obliquely, but obviously. Ozio would, of course, endorse no one. He was above that. He would hint, though. We assumed the hints would be devastating, and indeed Ozio quickly and very publicly went to New York Hospital and gave blood the day after Picker announced. The schedule that Howard and Lucille concocted, with the help of the Rucker organization, reminded me of the agenda Larkin and I had suffered through when he'd visited the Soviet Union in 1987, only in reverse. Instead of happy peasants and Potemkin villages, this was, relentlessly, unhappy interest groups and urban devastation. There was no spontaneity, no contact with citizens who happened not to be members of some organized group with a specific grievance. Every last stop seemed synthetic and massaged. These were New York liberalism's stations of the cross.
Is this going to get us there? Stanton asked that afternoon, when Howard presented his plan at the kitchen table in the mansion.
You go with what you got, Howard said. This is what we have.
Did you talk to Rucker?
He said he was happy that I was going to endorse UCSER, Stanton said.
What the fuck is that?
Urban Coalition Supporting Economic Recovery, Howard said. It's this group of mayors Rucker pulls together every year or so. They want to goose urban spending.
How? Stanton asks. Who the fuck knows, Howard said. They have a phantom piece of legislation, direct grants to cities.
For how much?
$40 billion. A year? Stanton asked.
Howard nodded. The governor whistled.
You're kidding.
He demanded it, Howard said.
Howard?
The governor started softly.
You and I have been buddies since forever. I love you like a brother. I don't trust anyone on this earth more. But you never, ever, ever commit a money figure on my behalf, he said, banging the table so hard the coffee mugs were jumping.
Never! Do you fucking understand?
We need him, Howard said calmly.
We can find a way to goddamn have him without his fucking blood money, Stanton screamed. This kind of shit is death in America. You won't get 18 votes for it in the rest of the country, and now I'm going to have to slip-slide my way out of it tomorrow.
There's one other thing, Howard said.
What?
Luther Charles wants to be part of the event at City Hall. Stanton looked at me.
Why?
I asked Howard. He said he wanted to begin the process of engagement.
Now what the fuck is that? Stanton asked.
The mating ritual, Howard said.
Henry?
Stanton said. He knew how I felt about Luther, but this whole conversation was distasteful. Where is Rucker on this? I asked, knowing the answer.
Deferential to Luther.
Okay, I guess it's on me then, I said. I'll call Luther and... Governor, set up a separate meeting at the hotel?
After the news cycle, Stanton said.
I placed a call to Luther Charles when I returned to headquarters, and then sat idly, swiveling in my chair, waiting for him to respond. It was a darkish day, the giant plate glass windows in our old auto dealership, so often blinding bright, and seducing a stubborn sunniness from the staff even at the diciest times, now seemed wet and woolen, tamping down spirits. The fact that the phones were just not ringing, that all politics seemed fixed on Picker, didn't help. I found myself thinking about Daisy, thinking about how she looked in that kilt. The past few days I realized I'd been thinking as much about Daisy as about the campaign. In fact, the campaign was feeling a bit foreign to me now, at first. The whole New York scenario was wrong, I knew that. It was the politics of reflex and obligation. You saw the obligatory groups, you made the obligatory promises, more money for the cities, an embassy in Jerusalem for the Jews, the release of a gun-running IRA terrorist for the Irish. But what worked for Jack Stanton had been less predictable, more spontaneous. Or maybe it was just that this was Howard's moment and I hated the son of a bitch. In any case, I took it out on Luther. I took some chances I probably shouldn't have.
Little brother, Luther purred. Why is it that I only hear from you in times of trouble? Sometimes I suspect the white politicians of this world look on old Luther as the Salvation Army, ready to help with the community in times of disaster. But I don't play that game. I'm the Salvation Liberation Army. I will save their asses if they will liberate my people.
Luther, this thing tomorrow isn't a good idea, I said suddenly, realizing that I'd made a careless mistake. I should have called Bobby Tompkins, Rucker's guy, and gotten him on board. Indolence is one of the perils of low morale, which is why it's so hard to turn around a campaign heading south, which was why Jack Stanton's New Hampshire performance had been so remarkable.
Isn't a good idea?
Luther repeated.
What isn't a good idea?
You showing up at the Rucker endorsement.
The mayor said that?
No, I haven't talked to Bobby yet, but think about it, I said. You think the mayor is going to want to be upstaged by the Luther Charles Salvation Liberation Army Review? I know you worked this through Bobby. I know he's your guy. And you know Richie Rucker will kick the shit out of him, make his ass suffer when the deal comes down. You hog the spotlight and the mayor turns out to be a bit player in his own endorsement of Jack Stanton. Now why, Luther, would you want to cause Bobby such pain? He didn't answer.
Henry, your boy needs me, he said instead. I am very big in the Apple, but I'm not going to come cheap. He will have to negotiate for my services. The Salvation Liberation Army has staffing needs, and I'm going to need a plane and a budget.
Luther, get real, I said. The governor will meet with you tomorrow night at his hotel. He's willing to talk, but don't make stupid demands.
Do I use the servant's entrance? He said. Carter gave me a plane and a budget. Mondale gave me a plane and a budget. You saying Jack Stanton isn't interested in support from the community?
I'm saying, Luther, that you are talking to me, I said. And I know you can rouse the community to come out and vote. For you. I don't know how much good you can do us, or how much harm. The governor likes you, Luther. He enjoys your brand of bullshit.
but the days when you could walk in and just demand a 737 and $10,000 a week are over. And if you start in, showing up where you shouldn't, distracting folks at the Rucker endorsement tomorrow, Stanton isn't going to have anything to say to you at all.
Showing up where I shouldn't?
Luther mimicked me.
If you're black, get black.
Luther, give it up.
I may have to have a discussion with Richmond Rucker about the viability of his endorsement, he said.
Be my guest, I said.
It will be an embarrassment if he pulled back now.
Yeah, it'll do wonders for his reputation for decisive thinking.
Henry Burton, my, my, he said. Ain't you the stony-ass Paul? You need to locate your soul vein. Maybe you should give some blood, like old Freddy Picker. Now there's a white boy with soul. Though I expect he's got himself a microscopic Johnson, his wife running off like that. You imagine the dude just coming out and saying it to Bryant like that?
And Luther switched to a white man's voice.
My wife fell in love with another man.
Then back again.
Jehoshaphat. The Caucasian trustometer shot up into the ionosphere. White folk love that shit. Black folk, they wonder about his willy.
So, Luther, are we set for tomorrow night?
Fuck no. I don't need to see your master right now. He gonna be like that. But I will do you a favor, Henry. I want to further your education. You gonna be staying your place?
I hadn't thought about that. I did have a home in New York. I hadn't been there in months. I'm not sure, I said.
Yeah, the hotel life is contagious. Am I right, my brother? And a body man gotta stay close to the body. So how's about we meet up in your old nave, the West End Bar?
At which point, I sensed a great rush of air.
Hey, Amnio Man! Hey, Amnio Man!
It was Libby, just barging in, doing a riff on the old Hey, Culligan Man commercial, waving a roll of brown wrapping paper in her hand. I began gesturing wildly, waving my arms, trying to shut her down.
Hey, Amnio Man!
You there, little brother? Luther asked. Something happening?
No, yeah, the West End Bar. What's this about?
You'll see. Say 11?
Right. I hung up.
Hey, Amnio Man,
Libby said.
Amnio Man, Amnio Man.
There were times when Libby just seemed crazy, ready for readmission. This was one of them. For God's sake, Libby, I said. You want the world to know? Henry? My little bitty, shit-heel, traitor, motherfucker, asshole, she said softly, sweetly. They are going to know, I think, I suppose. They may.
I slumped in my chair. It felt like the eighth time someone had run over me that day.
Okay, Libby, what's up?
I'll get to that, she said.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hey, Amnio Man! Hey, Amnio Man! Henry, 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 the girls' team thought you were simpatico, a fellow we could do business with. And you go along with this shit?
Libby, what do you want me to do?
Not,
she said,
not go along.
I was under a direct order from the governor.
Seek fucking hail, she said. Nuremberg for you, baby cakes. Now look at this.
She unrolled the brown wrapping paper on my desk. It was a series of double boxes. Seating charts, I realized. These are all of Loretta McAllister's classes, Libby said. She's the star pupil, pointing to gold stars marking her place in each class. She wishes. But let me direct your attention to the green stars. Second and fourth periods. There were green stars next to Loretta's gold. They represent the lithe young body of Kendra Mason. Libby looked at me to be sure I knew what was coming.
I did. Unfortunately.
Roger Melville Jones paid her family a visit 2 days ago. That dimwit limey prick. She lives with her mother and three half-whatevers by different daddies. And you know what? They are very interested in moving up in the world. Libby, be quiet for Christ's sake, I said.
So what did you do? Take out your gun, go over there and shoot them?
Ha fucking ha, she said.
But then she did quiet down. He offered them $100,000 right there to be on Sex Lives of the Rich and Famous, or whatever he calls that syndicated piece of cat hawker.
And the McAllisters? I asked.
Completely mortified,
she said. Fat Willie shut down the shack. Took a vacation for a couple of weeks. Slapped Loretta around for opening her mouth, too. You know, Henry, those are fine people. Melville Jones comes to the door and asks Willie, "Is your daughter pregnant?" And he says, "None of your fucking business. You don't get off my property, I'm going to call the cops." And Shitheel says, "Is the governor the father?" And Willie says, "The governor is a friend of mine," and slams the door. I mean, Henry, how could you let Howard Pencil Penis do that to Willie without stepping in that day?
I let that pass.
So all Melville Jones has is a girl who says another girl says the governor made her pregnant. Henry, he doesn't represent the New York fucking Times, Libby said. He also has a non-denial denial from the father of the bride.
On camera?
He don't leave home without it, she said. My guess, we hit Sex Lives of the Rich and Famous early next week. This is uglier than a hairy ass, she said. Can we get firmer denial from Willie? Henry, you really do take the fucking cake, she said. He could make a fucking fortune off us. He's been standing up throughout, and you're asking him to lie for us? Not lie, I said. I don't know. I'm sorry. You're right. Anyway, anything he says will be used against us. Where are they? I don't know if I want to tell you, Amnio man. Libby. They're up in a fishing shack in Montgomery County. I advanced for them. Nice trout stream. Willie can stand out there and cast all day, thinking about the business he's losing, she said. Oh, he'll have plenty of business when he gets back. This'll be good for business. Folks will want to come around. Folks will always remember who he is and what his daughter said the governor did. They'll come by just to see if the kid has Jack's wavy hair and shit-eating grin. He will never just be Fat Willie again. I could fucking kill Jack for this. He says he's not the father, I said. He's not, she said, crossing her arms and giving me a wicked look. How do you know that? I felt an adrenaline rush, a sudden exhilaration. You got the results? Not for a couple of weeks, says Dr. Sharon Wilkinson, OBGYN RSVP ASAP. She was spinning out again. PD fucking Q. Then how do you know?
Trust the dustbuster, she said.
It was just my woman's intuition, but I was into wishing you were here. Remember that song? Oh, you wouldn't. Too trashy. Oh, Henry, 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 Henry. Poor child. It doesn't matter whether he did or didn't, if she ever fucking once said he did. And we know she said it at least twice, to her daddy, and to Kendra, "I'm going to Disney World, Mason." Henry, grow up already. Shit begets shit. Kashmir made anything possible. And whether he did it or not, you think Jack Stanton wouldn't be capable of fucking the McAllister girl? You think he didn't? Libby, I don't get it. Why would... She cut me off.
Oh, shut up, Henry, she said. Why ask why?
Because it's just too fucking weird, I said. Weird isn't the word for it, she said. Try disgusting. Then what are you doing here? Oh, Henry. And she looked at me, suddenly sane. We are here because they need us here.
Luther Charles, like Jack Stanton, was the sort of man who created vibrations whenever he was in a room. The molecules moved differently. There was a sense of anticipation. And so it may well have been animal magnetism, rather than just a glint of light off his gold cufflinks, that led my eye directly to the Reverend when I walked into the West End bar, just after 11 the next night. I was somewhat jazzed, in any case. New York did that. It was like reverse jet lag. Everything was faster, noisier, more livid than Mammoth Falls. I had walked the streets of my old neighborhood, agog with the life of the place, the sheer number of people, bums and full professors wandering about mutually befogged, pasty-faced, Upper West Side types shopping the Korean fruit stands, Puerto Ricans with boomboxes and gold jewelry hanging on the corners. If you could handle this, everything else in America seemed half-speed and half-filled. I not only could handle it, it was, arguably, home. I debated whether to stop in and check out my old apartment. I got into the building itself, then chickened out, daunted by the expectation of roaches scattering in the light, daunted by the reminders of what my life had been after William Larkin and before Jack Stanton, the caesura it had been. I did, however, stop in on Mrs. Flores, the super, who had been forwarding my non-junk mail to Mammoth Falls. She was small and round, and given to unflattering tank tops.
"Henry? You back?" she said. "The governor man, he mess up all over the place."
"No, just checking in," I said. "I was just in the nabe, figured I'd pick up my mail."
"You go up?"
"No.
I keep fix. Have been 2 months. I bombed the fuck out of the last cucarachas. It's okay now, but they come back soon." "When you come back, Enrico?"
"Who knows," I said. "Maybe soon." "Any mail?"
"I just sent last week, but this come a few weeks before that. Gets lost abajo my dream book."
It was from father. It seemed not only from a different place, but from a different time. My old pen pal days, when the letters from Mohammed Sadiki and Arhur came in delicate sky blue envelopes. This letter was painfully thin. It consisted of a single sheet of tissue paper and a single, manual typed sentence. "Are you actually working for this man?" There was no "Dear Henry" or "Love Father." There was nothing on the page but the sentence. It seemed a physical assault, but different from Susan slapping me across the face. More like a full-fisted punch, dead center on my stomach. I could hardly breathe. And then I was furious. The son of a bitch had no right. He didn't have enough of an investment in my life to intrude like that, to hurt me like that. In retrospect, though, it was perfect. Perfect timing, given what transpired that night at the West End Bar. It was as if Luther and Father had coordinated this attack, their last desperate effort to salvage Henry before he slipped irredeemably into the veil of the pale. So, jazzed and smarting, reeling, actually, I spotted Luther immediately, sitting in a booth at the West End, looking conspicuously substantial in blue pinstripes and a white shirt with French cuffs and a gold collar pin. His tie, red and black divided vertically, seemed definitely downscale, a foot firmly planted in the Sunday service. He had put on weight over the years and lost some hair. Luther had peaked in full afro and dashiki. Rage defined him and became him. He looked plucked now. Luther in a suit was like Dukakis in a tank. He was with a woman, her back to me. He acknowledged my approach with nothing so welcoming as a smile. It was more a nod than a handshake. A greeting for a white person.
"Henry," he said, "this is Gail Powell, a law school classmate of your current employer and a member of the band."
"Of the band?" I asked, sitting down next to her. She was a striking woman, long and beautiful, her classic African profile accentuated by closely cropped hair, the first scattering ringlets of gray contributing to the air of dignity and integrity. She was wearing a pearl-gray silk blouse and dark slacks, a small gold cross necklace, simple pearl earrings.
"Partners three," she smiled, nodding over to the bandstand. "Some pals from the firm, Jennings, Jenkins, and Abercrombie. We noodle here, now and again."
"This sister," Luther began, but was interrupted by the waitress.
I assessed the table. Luther was drinking coffee, Gail Power, something brown. Bourbon, it seemed. I had gotten into the habit of drinking margaritas with a double shot, Daisy's drink, but clearly that would not do in this company. I ordered a beer.
"This sister can tell you some things about Jack Stanton," Luther said.
"Some things?" I asked.
"Well, we had a thing," she said, beyond cool.
"More than a thing," Luther said. "Tell him."
"Yeah, more than a thing. We were pretty tight. There were times when, well, you know Jack."
"I know him now," I said. "What was he like back then?"
"Same as now. Maybe a little shinier," she said. "He glowed."
"You knew Bill Johnson?" I asked.
"Of course," she said. "There weren't enough of us not to know each other. Not to be in each other's face on a daily basis, you know. We were pulling for each other, pulling hard. Didn't want to be embarrassed. And I've got to say, Jack was right there with us. Her number of the white boys didn't even see us, too grogged out with the
ambition sickness. Others made a pass at it. But Jack was right there. He was easy with the blood, you know what I mean? He didn't have to work at it. He could sing the birds from the trees. There were times when I actually did think, he and I would open up that little mom-and-pop legal services clinic he was always talking about.
He used the sister, Luther said.
She laughed lightly. Now there's a newsflash. Black woman used by white dude. Luther, let me lawyer you a little. Use ain't abuse. I can tell you all about abuse. You knew Susan too, I guess? I asked.
Oh yeah, she said. But not so well.
You're too young to remember the old toothpaste commercials. Colgate with Gardol, the invisible protective shield. With Susan, it just didn't stop at the mouth.
He didn't love her? I asked.
She laughed again. I thought you worked for the man. Jack loved her, of course he did. He loved her. He loved me. He loved every stray cat in the quad. That boy is not deficient in the love zone. He's got more than enough to go around, and it's all legit. He's never faking it. I'm sure he thought he and I were going to settle down, open a legal services clinic, and have mocha chip babies, whenever he was thinking it. Trouble was, he was thinking too many other things, too.
He led the sister on, Luther said, half-heartedly now.
This wasn't turning out the way he'd expected.
He went with a white girl because an interracial marriage wouldn't be politically viable.
There is that, Gail said, sipping her whiskey, rolling the glass between her palms, studying it. But you always had two things going on with Jack, your mind and your heart. In my mind, I knew I'd never really have him. He was too needy, and it wasn't the usual male kind of needy. It wasn't just come and blow. He was needy the way a woman is. He needed the physical proximity more than the other. You wouldn't know about this, Reverend, she said wickedly, looking across at Luther. He was...
darling.
She seemed almost surprised by her choice of words. He was a lovely boy. Your heart went out to him. He found a way to make you do that. And no, Luther, she wagged a finger at the Reverend. It wasn't exploitation. I don't think it was ever about domination, having his way. It was about needing and just getting off on being close. He got as much pure pleasure out of just being there, touching, being touched, watching, hanging out, as any man I ever knew. She turned and looked at me. Her eyes were simultaneously onyx sharp and heavy-lidded. Of course, in my mind, I knew Jack Stanton was scheduled for something other than legal services, and in that way, Susan was the obvious choice. But it wasn't the Cole thing, the partnership, people say. I'd be willing to bet you anything that he got to her. Same way he got to me. Same way he got to all of us. I'll bet you anything he penetrated that white girl's invisible protective shield. If he hadn't, he couldn't have married her. You gotta know that Jackie can't stand not being loved. Other thing is, if he didn't, she wouldn't have put up with his shit all these years, too proud. Listen, fellas, I've got to... I stood up, allowed her to slip past. She was much taller than me. Reverend, she bowed. Mr. Burton, she kissed my hand. She took a step away and said, You know, Henry, I was going to say, it's too bad. He would have been a great guy if he hadn't wanted to be a great man. But that'd be cheap, wouldn't it? Anyway, I bet somewhere beneath all the bullshit, he's probably still a great guy. She moved off, done with us, moving toward the music.
So, Luther, that was my education? I said when she'd gone.
Look at her, Luther said. That is one sad sister. She's still not over that sucker. And that's your fate too, Henry. He's making good use of your pigment. But what do you get out of it? What power do you have? You gave up your heritage and your leverage to carry a white man's coat.
I couldn't take my eyes off Gail Powell. There was a weary erudition to her. A bluesy wisdom. I wondered if she was a different, crisper Gail Powell at Jennings, Jenkins, and Abercrombie. She went over to the bandstand, joined a white piano player and a black drummer. She played bass.
She plays bass?
Yeah, you don't often see it, Luther said.
Sister playing bass, it's puzzling, given how much the sisters get off on that instrument. Plucks their magic twanger. At least, that's what they say, he said, checking me out. My, my, Henry Burton. You think I'm crude? Well, ain't you ever your grandpappy's grandkid? Hey, how much you remember the great man?
Not much, I said. I remembered his fingers, my little ones threading through his big, thick ones. I remembered the smell of cigars coming off of him. He read James Weldon Johnson. Luther immediately launched a recitation.
When I've drunk my last cup of sorrow, when I've been called everything but a child of God, when I'm done traveling up the rough side of the mountain.
Luther boomed it out, eyes toward heaven. Heads turned in that dark, boozy room. He was, certifiably, one of God's trombones. That was his favorite, wasn't it? I said. Luther nodded and skipped to the end.
Lower me to my dusty grave in peace.
He was standing now, waving his teaspoon, playing to the crowd.
To wait for that great getting up morning. Amen.
He luxuriated in the getting up just exactly as Grandfather had. Luther sat down, he looked at me. We looked at each other hard, for the first time, really. We had made a connection. We could talk now. He searched my face as if he were looking for traces of my grandfather in me, or maybe my dad. Did he teach it to you? I asked. Then, before he could answer, I moved closer to the point. What was he like?
God, Luther laughed. He was like God, except he had faults, and we knew all about them. But he was still like God, still the voice from the mountaintop looking down on us, looking down on me. I was always the token, the ignorant street nigger in his charmed fucking circle. Too bad he didn't get to know you. He would have just loved your scrawny ass. You're just his type. Classy, pale, dignified. Rev was black as night, but he loved the yellow boys, especially the ones come up from the university, he said venomously.
He went to Hampton, I said.
The university, Luther insisted. Where'd your daddy go? University of Chicago? You look at the roster. The so-called charm circle. Where'd Reverend Artemus Jackson go? Yellow Artie went to Yale. Like that. The Rev loved brothers who ate chicken with a knife and fork instead of their hands. Wore shirt with collars. I never seen such a thing. I come up on the south side. My daddy could have been anyone on the block. That discomforted him, the Reverend Mr. Burton. He was also discommoded by my lack of patience and manners and couth. And he was also discommoded by your father's lack of interest.
It wasn't a lack of interest, I said. He was just interested in other things.
He was interested in being interested in other things than the Rev was, that's for damn sure.
Luther laughed.
He wanted no part of the crusade, and he was most assuredly not into reconciliation. That made us a pair, your daddy and me. We were among the first who weren't colored, the first who were black, years before Stokely and them found the proper word for it. Color was nice. Color meant you could be mocha or magenta or chartreuse. You could be pleasing to the eye like a Monet water lily. Refined brothers we called watercolored, your daddy and me. See, the lovely thing about black was, it wasn't nice. It was opposition, darkness. It was a great big fuck no. It was too hard for Rev, he was colored.
Well, that doesn't sound like my father, angry, I said. I don't remember him ever raising his voice. He just kind of kept his distance from everything.
Ironically, Luther said. He kept his distance, ironically. See, he knew. He knew the Rev's get-together with Whitey shit wasn't going to make it. He also knew my fuck-the-motherfuckers gambit didn't have much of a future. He was, well, you know this. He was into antiquity, looking to where our sorry asses came from. He knew the get-together with Whitey shit wouldn't make it, and not just because those sick motherfuckers still can't even look us in the eye, but because we were too damn uncomfortable with our own skins to negotiate credibly.
no matter how fucking proud we play-acted back then. We weren't ready to be equal. Can't blame us, I guess. We had just cause. We were moving with all deliberate speed, but that's why I could never understand.
What? I asked, but I knew what.
Your mother, he said. I never could understand what he saw in her, aside from the obvious. But then, look at the sister. He nodded over to the bandstand, where Partners Three had drifted into a slow, dreamy version of Time After Time. Gail Powell caressing the bass, eyes closed tight. She could have had any man. She didn't want none of us. You can't say shit about other folks loving or not loving. I can't tell you what kind of voodoo your mother laid on him, or what was in your daddy's heart. Luther smiled. The heart is a lonely hustler.
We were quiet for a moment, listening to the music.
Henry, Luther finally said, your daddy ain't around, so I'm the only member of the Rev's rump caucus available to do the honors. So listen, I know you can't do my thing. I know you're embarrassed by my thing. It ain't worth doing much longer anyways, most likely. But we were kind of counting on you to figure out the next thing, you know? Booker T. Washington was full of shit, right? We can't live with him like fingers on a hand. We're always getting thumb-fucked. We can't live with him. We can't live without him. Can't ever fucking trust him. And who wants to, anyway? Truth is, they are just plain disgusted by us, most of them. So the Rev's thing won't work. My thing won't work. It's on you and yours to figure out the next move.
Me? I said. Jesus, Luther. You think I got some mission just because of my last name? I'm not a preacher, I'm a Paul. I do what I do. I'm good at it, I like it, most of the time.
Exactly so, little brother, he said. You could have been a dentist, or a golf pro, or go off to Cairo like your daddy. But you chose to be in the arena, and so it falls on you. I know you went with Stanton because you figured you might be the second most powerful man in the world if you won.
I did not, I lied.
Right. There's always the toothpaste woman, right? Luther said. She's number two. But you figured it was your ticket to the West Wing, and who knows? You might have got there. But even if you had, even if you do, you got more important business than that, taking the Rev's business the next stop down the line. I hoped it would be me, you know? I wanted it to be me, not those sophisticated academia niggas. I was the rightful heir, and man, I couldn't fucking handle it when he died. I cried and cried. And yeah, I made my move too, and the circle been talking trash about me ever since. Luther the fallen angel. Well, get thee behind me, suckers. Who made the brothers feel better about themselves, me or the yellow boys? I ran for the president, debated with those white boys, damn near took them out. And down on the street, they were listening to those debates like they listened to Joe Louis in the 30s.
He stopped. He seemed to realize he'd gone into self-justificatory bullshit, and that wasn't where he wanted to be. He smiled a little and said,
Henry, I hated the rest fucking ass. But I hated him like a son hates a father, knowing that he'd never see me the way I wanted him to. And you're his blood, and I don't care what your rationale is, but the Reverend Harvey Burton would not have been proud to see his grandson a servant to some southern governor.
Oh, come on, Luther, I said. You know he's not just some southern governor.
That's not the point, son, he said, his eyes softening, reaching a big hand over onto my arm. It ain't the quality of the governor. It's the quality of your service.
That Saturday was awful. We were supposed to launch our New York campaign with a rally at Restoration Plaza in Bed-Stuy. Then Stanton would helicopter up to Connecticut for a quick round of events. Rucker wanted Bed-Stuy wired, we were told. Great pictures for the Sunday papers, we were told. The place was desolate. No one was there. It was as if someone had done reverse advance work, as if the heart of Bedford-Stuyvesant had been evacuated. There was a band playing in the empty plaza, a soul band with a woman screaming off-key, Chaka Khan. This woman, we would later learn, was the sister of the press secretary of the deputy mayor for economic development and would cost the Stanton campaign $2,000. There were five or six heavily bundled and not very enthusiastic volunteers billed at $100 per head for the afternoon, ready to distribute Stanton literature and bumper stickers and stick-on buttons to anyone who happened by. But no one was happening by. It was, to be fair, an unappetizing March day. Cloudy, near freezing and blustery. But it was a Saturday. The NCAA basketball semifinals wouldn't start till later that afternoon. And Rucker had promised a crowd. We arrived in a van, trailed by a press bus filled with our national regulars. The utterly unregenerate and incorruptible New York scorps would never hit us up for transit. They arrived separately, in their own cars, with special press plates that enabled them to park illegally just about anywhere.
Henry, I'm not stepping out of this van until we find the mayor and figure out what the fuck is going on here, Stanton said.
I called Bobby Tompkins. Where are you? I asked.
Here, he said. We're in a holding room across the plaza. I can see you just pulled up. Let's get it on.
Where are the people? I asked. Where's the crowd?
A fuck up, Bobby said. We got fucked. We were depending on the Brooklyn organization to advance it.
Well, you know how these things sometimes are between the Brooklyn and Harlem organizations. There's, you know, a rivalry. Sometimes they don't want us to look too good. And I'm sure in this case they probably got a message from Albany saying this might not be a time for Harlem to shine. Of course, if you ask them, they'll probably tell you some incredible story about signals missed, and wasn't it supposed to be tomorrow? But I won't bullshit you. They fucked us.
What's going on? Stanton growled, turning back toward me from his usual spot in the front seat.
The mayor, Bobby said.
Hold it, I said to Bobby.
What do you mean, hold it? Stanton screamed.
The mayor, Bobby said.
I cupped the phone. They screwed up. Something about Ozzio and the Brooklyn organization. But this is all they've got for us.
So what do they propose we do? Stanton asked.
So what do you want to do? I asked Tompkins.
The mayor wants to go ahead with it, Bobby said.
The mayor wants to go ahead with it, I told Stanton, who ripped the phone out of my hand. I gave him a look. He gave an immediate, contrite flicker of response, but still.
Bobby? You can tell the mayor I ain't going ahead with no goddamn thing that involves me speaking to three stray dogs and a wino, Stanton said.
He what? You're kidding. Bobby, put him on the goddamn phone.
He won't. Shit.
I guess we have a standoff. He hung up. I asked what the story was.
The mayor, if you can fucking believe this, wants to deliver his speech. He wants to speak to this empty plaza. He says it isn't empty, there are scorps. He says he's already issued a press release and a text, so he has to deliver it.
Stanton was nonplussed, half laughing and half about to punch out the window.
If it's anything like that snoozer he gave the other day at City Hall endorsing me, he probably ought to think twice. But I don't think that's within the realm of his capabilities. Oh, the other real terrific thing is, he won't talk to me on the phone. He thinks it's improper for principals to talk on the phone.
Well, we've got to work out something, I said. I'll go over and talk to them.
I've got half a mind just to pull out of here. But yeah, I guess you're right, he said.
So what should I settle for? I asked.
Settle for? Stanton asked, petulant.
What do you want?
A crowd.
Short of that, I said.
To fucking kill that asshole, Stanton screamed, then calmed. I don't know. Maybe we should just work the streets.
All right, I said. I walked across the plaza, past scraggly, newly planted linden striplings, toward a vacant storefront where two mayoral security guards framed the door. The area was empty in the distinctive, depressing manner of overly optimistic urban renewal cityscapes. It had recently been spiffed up, brick walkways, an African pride mural, and teetered at a sterile apogee of non-decline. Wind whipped fat bunches of undistributed Stand for Stanton handbills against brick planters and into the whitewashed corners of the plaza. Several New York scorps moped about at the storefront entrance, but happily, they didn't recognize me. The mayor did. Mr. Burton, he said, not rising from a desk planted below a bare light bulb in the middle of an empty storefront. Indeed, he hardly looked up from a Greek salad in a tin takeout tray. This is unfortunate. Hey, man, Bobby Tompkins said, coming over, shaking my hand. He was a large man, with a dark, battered face. It hadn't surprised me to learn that he'd played nose tackle for Cutston State and came from a freeholding Pennsylvania farm family. He had a sane, steady decency to him. He was truly embarrassed by this. The mayor wasn't. Mr. Burton, he said, when do you think the governor will see fit to emerge from his vehicle and allow us to begin this event? I couldn't tell if he was mocking me with his bitter formality or whether he always spoke like that. He sat regally in the midst of the redeveloped but never reoccupied storefront. There were stray ladders, bare sheetrock walls, blueprints, and a thin layer of construction dust. He was wearing a black satin Spike Lee 40 acres and a mule baseball jacket over a white shirt with a perfectly starched collar and an elegant silver tie. An aide stood to the side, carrying a severely unwrinkled blue double-breasted blazer in clear plastic wrap on a hanger. There was a boombox on the desk. The mayor was listening to lattish, lugubrious Billie Holiday. I don't know why I love you like I do. The governor, I said, isn't going to give a speech to an empty plaza. The governor abuses my hospitality, the mayor said, again barely looking at me. I didn't exist, I was dirt. I think, sir, the governor's trying to do you a favor, I said. The way things stand now, the national press will report tomorrow that Richmond Rucker can't raise a crowd in Brooklyn. We have to find a way around that. The way things stand now, young man, he said, finally looking at me with rhiny blue-green eyes and unconcealed disdain, the New York press will report continuing friction between the Harlem and Brooklyn organizations several paragraphs down. Their lead will be that Governor Stanton's campaign has had a rocky start in the city, that it is having difficulty engendering much enthusiasm. And then there will be a paragraph or two reporting on my speech, denouncing federal indifference to our situation in the cities, and reminding people about the UCSER initiative. I was tempted to say, right, we need UCSER to build more urban wastelands like this one, and I wonder how many of your pals got construction contracts. But I am a professional, as was Bobby Tompkins, who gave me a, you see what I had to deal with, I'll bet you got troubles too look. Mr. Mayor, I mean this with the greatest respect, I said, but there is no way on earth Jack Stanton is going to join you at that lonely podium in that empty plaza unless you find some people to fill it. The governor would like to discuss this with you directly. All you have to do is pick up the phone. That would be unseemly, Rucker said. And that was all he said. I looked at my watch. Mr. Mayor, it's now 1:50. I'm going to walk across that plaza and tell the governor about this, and then, at 2 o'clock, Governor Stanton is going to begin a walking tour down Fulton Street, accompanied by the national press. Don't threaten me, boy, he said, rising, leaning forward on the desk. And whoever taught you manners? Don't look at your watch in the presence of a superior unless he asks you the time. And tell the governor that at 2 o'clock I'm going to deliver my address here, in the plaza, with him or without. So I walked back across and told Jack. I said to Daisy as we rode the E-train that night out to Forest Hills. And we went our way, and Rucker gave his speech, and the press was all over both of us. And the story tomorrow will be about the public rift between the governor and the mayor and the disastrous start for the Stanton campaign in New York. Shit, she said. And the furtive cipher, was he all apologies? No, I said. Howard said, you have to handle the mayor very carefully. And Jack said, like toxic waste. Actually, the weird thing, and of course, you could have predicted this, was that Jack was feeling pretty up after all that street work. He had a wonderful time on Fulton Street, and I think we got some real great pictures out of it. He must have hugged every overweight black woman in Brooklyn. So he lives to fight another day? Daisy asked. I don't know, I said. He always does. Daisy?
What?
She asked and took my hand. We pulled into Queens Plaza. People got on and off. I keep thinking about the conversation I had with Luther Charles the other night. It started out about the usual bullshit, him endorsing us or not, the terms of his blackmail, but it somehow moved on to my grandfather. He talked a lot about the Rev and about my father. You know, I'd never talked to him about it. I just remembered the others riffing on him, dismissing him. All my uncles, in the charmed circle, had their take on Luther. They laid it on him all the time. And no doubt they were right. But he has his side, too. That's what I learned the other night. He loved the Rev as much as any of them. And he really knew my father, better than I do, most likely. Anyway, Luther finally said, the Reverend Harvey Burton would have never wanted his grandson to be a servant to some southern governor. I told him Jack wasn't just some southern governor, and he said, maybe not, but you're just a servant. Luther was gaming you, Henry, Daisy said, outraged. You aren't a servant. You know that. You run this thing. More than anyone else. Don't you see how people, Jack, Susan, look to you at any given meeting? Someone comes up with a goofy idea, you lift an eyebrow, and it's done. You are Mr. Sanity. They'd be lost without you. Isn't that what people always say about a good butler? Henry, you are deputy campaign manager of a presidential campaign, and the campaign manager is an asshole, and everyone looks to you. You call that being a servant? By that standard, the only people who aren't servants are CEOs. Yeah, well, okay. I looked around the subway car. It was an old habit of mine, scoping the car, thinking about what sort of society the passengers would form if we were stranded in a tunnel. What would happen if we learned that nuclear missiles were headed toward New York, and we only had 10 minutes to live? Which woman I'd want to pair up with before the great getting-up morning? This car was pretty empty. There were sales clerks coming home after a long day at Macy's or Bloomie's. There were immigrants, Indians, Pakistanis, Latinos, exhausted but relieved, thrilled to be where they were, on a New York subway, heading home. There were older Jewish men and women coming home after a Saturday afternoon of culture in Manhattan. There were several thermonuclear love-in candidates among the sales clerks. Good-looking brown-skinned girls, carefully put together, the sort of girls you see behind the makeup counter. They could have been Latinos, South Asians, almost anything. Ethnic distinctions were being pureed in Queens. Under normal circumstances, all my life, in fact, I'd flirted with these girls in subway cars, made eye contact, smiled, fantasized. But here was Daisy, fiercely holding my hand, and I looked at her as I might have looked at a stranger. I would never pick her out of a crowded car. She wasn't unattractive, she was cute, close up. But she was not the stuff of fantasy. Her hair, which flopped down over her eyes when we made love, was pinned back precisely on both sides, barretted. She had dressed a bit for the visit to Mom. She was wearing a black, simple, elegant overcoat, a wine-red scarf, a white silk dress shirt, and black slacks. And the very act of looking at her that way, as a stranger, became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I felt disconnected. I didn't know her. This was, I realized, about the most banal thought in the male-female courtship playbook. But there it was, and she sensed it. Henry, it's been a really shitty day, she said. And just wait till you meet my mother. Her mother was dressed like a gypsy, or perhaps the sale rack at a second-hand folk costume store. She wore a high-necked, embroidered red and black on white cotton, Russian-styled narodniki blouse, a floor-length black Indian skirt with elaborate crueled flowers in horizontal bands, and a multicolored Andean, or perhaps African, bandana, which covered her head. I thought for a moment that she might be a recent chemotherapy patient, but stray wisps of gray snuck out at her ears. This head covering was a fashion statement. She was wearing dangly Mexican silver and turquoise earrings. The immediate effect was too much. She seemed to gasp as she opened the door to her apartment, as if to say, "You actually brought him." Ruth Green, she announced, sticking out her hand. I am so pleased to meet you. Her apartment was the museum of the Popular Front. Bare, undistinguished Danish modern furniture, overwhelmed by an international brigade of people's art. A Ben Shahn, Sacco and Vanzetti poster, in which the Italian anarchists are made to seem simple, bemused immigrant working men. The famous Martha Graham photo, head down, fist to forehead, everything akimbo in glorious consternation. A Fasanelli poster, Guatemala wall hangings, Dagon sculpture, and enough plants to create a weather system. On her coffee table, placed with an almost grotesque lack of subtlety, was Plowing Our Field, Planting a Dream, Sermons by the Reverend Harvey Burton. I've been so nervous about this, Ruth Green said. I could see Daisy in her. Daisy, older, lonelier, slouched a bit. It was not an attractive thought. I keep thinking about the Langston Hughes poem. You must know it. Incredibly, she began to recite. I know I am the Negro problem, being wined and dined, answering the usual questions that come to white mind, which seeks demurely to probe in polite ways the why and wherewithal of darkness USA. And then it goes on, she sputtered. There are more lines, I don't remember all of it, but eventually the white host says, I'm so ashamed of being white. And I know I shouldn't, but I can't help feeling that way. I do. This is such a racist country. We've been so ugly toward, each other. It's so difficult to break through the barriers and, you know, talk. I mean, I was such a devoted follower of your grandfather's. I can hardly believe you're Daisy's... Which is why I've been so nervous. She stopped, looked at me, blinked. I just wanted that out on the table. It's so awkward between the races most of the time, but I guess you two have dealt with that in your own way. Yikes! Daisy rolled her eyes, then said with them, See, I told you so. I thought, I have stumbled into Negro Poetry Month. First Luther, now this. They were symmetrical. With Luther, the poetry had been a lovely nostalgic breakthrough. This was quite the opposite. Can I get you something? Ruth Green asked, calming a bit. She had worked hard on her opening statement and was relieved that it was now over, and was quite oblivious to its impact on the company assembled. Seltzer? Beer? A beer, I said. I'll have one too, Daisy said, not having been asked, not having been looked at, so far as I could tell, by her mother. You know where they are, Ruth now said to her. Why don't you get three? As soon as Daisy walked out into the kitchen, Ruth turned to me. Don't you think Daisy's underemployed? She's got a PhD in public policy. She did a thesis on structural flaws in the Canadian single-payer system. She should be doing serious policy work, don't you think? She should be at the Urban Institute or something. I don't like this political commercial business. Negative advertising, always negative. How can you raise up people, always being so negative? She's very good at it, Mrs. Green, I said. Did she ever tell you I used to do population control work for the United Nations before I started teaching? Daisy was back with the beers, mortified. Mom, policy schmalacy, she said, too cheery, handing me a can of Bud Light. You design these things, the politicians screw them up. Nothing ever really works. Daisy, really? You sound like a neocon. Henry, policy does matter, doesn't it? Tell her. Daisy, you couldn't bring glasses? I looked at Daisy. I started to say something, but she jumped in. Of course policy matters, Mom. It's just not what I like to do. And I'll get the glasses. So you sell soap. Let it go, Mom. Did Daisy ever tell you about her father? May he rest in peace. Ruth asked, turning to me again as Daisy returned to the kitchen. She had her daughter's eyes, or rather, her eyes were shaped like Daisy's. She didn't have Daisy's eyes. Daisy saw everything and always understood what she was seeing. It was disconcerting looking into Daisy's eyes and seeing them blind. He was a union official, I said. An organizer, Ruth said reverently, glaring reproachfully toward the kitchen, as if Daisy hadn't explained her father well enough. She stood up, went over to the plain maple sideboard, opened the top drawer, and came out with a picture of Daisy's father. He had a mustache, wire-rimmed glasses, and a sly, knowing smile. He had seen everything, too.
This was Max, Ruth said. Max did the toughest work, organizing textile factories down south. He was beaten, badly beaten, once in Greenville.
He had his heart attack in High Point, North Carolina. I nodded, trying to communicate that Daisy had told me all this, though Ruth didn't appear to notice.
Anyway, he always said the reason organizing had gotten so hard toward the end was television.
Max, he said, didn't know from opiates. And here's Max Green's daughter doing television.
And not doing public television, Daisy said, returning. She had been here before, obviously.
Go ahead, make jokes, Ruth Green said, suddenly morose. But you could be doing something for the people.
Mom, what's for dinner? Daisy asked, clearly hoping to move things along.
Boneless chicken breasts, Ruth said. It's in the refrigerator. There's also some fresh broccoli.
Daisy, could you be a darling girl and fix it up for us? You're so much better than I am at that sort of thing.
Henry and I will set the table. And could you cook up some rice?
More symmetry. Daisy came after me that night in the hotel the same way I'd come after her on kilt night. There was an edge of desperation in it, an edge of, please, please disregard what just happened. I can make you feel very happy. But she was trying too hard. We were all arms and elbows. At one point, she bit my earlobe and I said, ouch!
So, I asked afterward, what are the structural flaws in the Canadian single-payer system?
Oh, God, she said. I know you know I'm not her. I know that. But you see pieces of her in me, like maybe the fact that I'm saying this right now. She would be doing this. She would have bit your ear too hard.
Shit, 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 Henry.
She pounded the pillow, sat bolt upright, zipped her mouth shut, and threw away the key. She said. I reached down, over the side of the bed, and came back with a key. I turned it in her left dimple and unzipped her mouth. I'm sorry, she said. Really, really sorry.
Don't worry about it, I said.
But she could tell I had been freaked by her mother.
Henry, I'll make you a deal. If we turn out to be, like, together, I mean, for a while, she said, if it'll make you feel any more comfortable, I will kill my mother, literally. I'll do it with my own hands.
If you really want to hurt her, I said, maybe you should hire a couple of proletarians to do the job.
They could tie her up in the chair first and make her watch hours upon hours of negative spots, Daisy said, and then force her to actually cook fucking dinner for them. And then they could strangle her while reciting Langston Hughes.
She was up on one elbow, playing with my hair. I was staring at the ceiling.
Henry, why are we here? She asked. Why aren't we at your apartment?
I don't know, I said. I have the feeling it's not my apartment anymore. I'm not the guy who used to live there. Or maybe it's what Luther said. Body man's got to stay close to the body. Or maybe it's just that Mrs. Flores doesn't do room service.
Henry, do not buy that servant shit, she said. It's race stuff. It's Luther fucking with you.
I don't know, I said. Jack grabbed the cell phone out of my hand today during the Rucker business. And Rucker, he acted like I was lower than dirt. Luther's got me noticing that stuff now.
That makes them assholes, she said. It doesn't make you a servant. Henry, you can't let this stuff get to you.
But she knew it was getting to me. All of it.
There was still a presidential campaign going on, though it had surprisingly little to do with Jack Stanton. Our Rucker ruckus, Stanton standoff, as the Sunday News inevitably put it, was news in New York, but barely made a ripple in the rest of the country. The rest of the country was madly in love with Freddie Picker. It was a sudden, hectic infatuation. He would appear on the covers of Time, Picker Fever, Newsweek, Make Room for Freddie, and People, Picker Mania, that week. He would be interviewed by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes that Saturday night. It had already been taped. Picker and Leslie walking the grounds of his environmentally correct Florida plantation. He was wearing a denim work shirt, overalls, high riding boots, and a camouflage cap. "You're a hunter, Governor Picker?" she had asked. "Not for sport," he smiled. "For food. I can rustle you up some picker-shot quail for dinner, if you want to stick around." He was, as Daisy had sensed, very good. He moved ever so easily away from Lawrence Harris's more extreme positions. No more talk of a virgin uses fee or a 50-cent tax on anything. "Everybody knows we gotta do something," he said on his first Larry King show. "It'd be sort of foolish for me to stand up here now in the middle of a campaign and say just exactly what it is we're going to do, Larry. To close the deficit, we need to raise some money." He casually turned away from King and addressed the camera. "Senator Harris figured there were ways we could do it that would also protect the environment. I think that's a pretty damn good idea. But we've got to wait until this country elects a president and he sits down with the folks in Congress and works out the precise details." "You're saying Harris was wrong, to be specific?" Picker laughed. "Ah, come on now, Larry. That's not worthy of you. You're trying to play gotcha. The folks know what I'm saying. Next topic." We still didn't know all that much about him. The first profiles were flattering, of course. He had been a businessman before becoming governor, had moved his family's Pensacola-based oil equipment supply company into oil lease speculation, and traded brilliantly, catching the wave just before the first Arab oil embargo, then leaving the business to his younger brother, Arnie, in order to dabble in politics. He appeared to have a great sense of timing. He launched himself into a 1974 gubernatorial campaign as a Democrat against the exhausted, befuddled incumbent. He campaigned in a leisure suit with a broom. The broom, the leisure suit, the sideburns, the hawk-like nose and eyes, the big smile made him immediately popular with political cartoonists, and so the public. His marriage in mid-campaign to Antonia Reyes Cardinale, the daughter of a wealthy Cuban furniture dealer and a Nicaraguan heiress, helped with the normally Republican Latino vote. He won election easily. A big future was predicted. It was one of those victories that Washington political columnists, always in the hunt for new talent, picked up on immediately. A charismatic big state governor is always worth checking out. Libby's research turned up a ripple of speculative columns about Picker soon after he took office. He did not discourage the speculation. He said, "Being president might be a fun thing to do. They need some sweeping out up in Washington, too." But he never really acted on it. He never really acted on much of anything as governor. There were no great Picker initiatives, no great Picker scandals, no great Picker tax increases or tax cuts. Things seemed to run pretty smoothly. He was well-liked. Two sons were born. There was another ripple, smaller, speculating that he might make a good vice presidential candidate in 1976. But Jimmy Carter's surge pretty much put an end to that. A Georgia-Florida ticket would never fly. He endorsed Carter. "Hell, we practically grew up in the same neighborhood," he said. And then, nothing. Until the strange press conference in March of 1978, an event that had clearly been planned as an announcement of his re-election campaign. There were photos of Picker, black hair parted in the middle and curling down over his collar, looking anguished. His wife, an exquisite woman, dark hair pulled back in a bun, standing just before him to the right, holding one of their sons in her arms, and tears in her eyes. After the famous line, "I was going to announce for re-election, but I changed my mind," he added, "I guess I'm just not cut out for this work. You want a more patient man than me. I hope you'll indulge me a little by not asking too many more questions about it." There was a headline over an analysis piece in the Miami Herald several days later that pretty much summed up the local press reaction to Picker's retirement. "He just got bored." There was no speculation about personal problems or marital difficulties, and by the time the divorce was announced, 6 months after he left office, Freddie Picker was no longer news.
"It's just a giant fucking look, fucking here sign. A solid gold invitation to scrutinize, don't you think?"
Richard said that Sunday morning, sitting in the coffee shop of our nondescript Lexington Avenue Hotel near Grand Central.
"But everyone's too damn lovesick to do much looking now. They'll get around to it in a few weeks.
Course, we may be deader than Eleanor Roosevelt by then. Shit, Henry, how much would you trust any of these guys who said he just got bored? How many of them get bored with power? With all these nubile teeny-bop muffins and munchkins padding around saying, "Ooh, governor, can I get you this or maybe that? Can I clip your toenails?"
"Maybe he's different," I said. "Maybe he's the real thing."
"The real thing? What on earth is that, Henri? There's no such thing. Not in this business. Not this century."
"FDR?"
"Okay, but only because he was a cripple and had to live with pain every day," he said. "FDR minus polio is George Bush."
"Oh, come on."
"Callow, cheesy rich boy, summers up in Maine, sends a lot of thank you notes. Henri, never underestimate the educational power of sheer fucking pain."
"Maybe then Picker's been educated," I said.
"Maybe,"
he said, taking a sip of Diet Coke, which, along with a barely pecked out stack of pancakes, was his breakfast.
"But it's a curious thing, don't you think? It's got old Libby curious. Bumped into Lucille this morning, and she told me Libby was kind of obsessing on Picker. Turning out she worked for him in 74.
"Well, not really worked. She volunteered. She wore a button and said, 'I'm a Picker person.' Remember, all these folks, Jack and Susan, Lucille, the Lipster, all of them were working for McGovern down there in 72. Libby stayed on, hung out in Margaritaville. Gotta figure, if there's anything there, she'll rattle it to the ground."
"If there's anything there," I said.
"When has there not been anything there lately?" Richard said.
"There's always something there. He's Paul. Look at the moves he's making. You don't come off Harris's high horse smooth as he has and not be a Paul."
But that wasn't quite true. Picker wasn't acting like the sort of politician we were used to. He hadn't brought on any consultants. In fact, he'd let Paul Shapley go. He had announced on Larry King that he wouldn't do any 30-second spots, or polling, or focus groups.
"I'm not going to hire a bunch of folks to tell me what you're thinking and how to get at you," he said.
"Maybe you're right, Henri," Richard scoffed. "Maybe he ain't a Paul. Maybe he's fucking Jesus Christ.
Ain't hard to be Jesus of the week in this business. For a week."
"2 weeks, though, kind of stretches the envelope."
"The blood thing is saintly," I said.
"The blood thing is politics. A fucking stroke of genius," Richard said.
"Do you realize that every last one of my clients, every last one of the mangy suckers, called this week to ask if they should go down and donate a fucking pint of blood? It's like it was after that Supreme Court nominee. What was his name? Ginsburg? Yeah. After he said he'd smoked a couple of joints, every last one of my clients called within 24 hours to find out what they should say about marijuana. And they were right to ask. Scorps asked every fucking alderman in the country that week if they'd gotten high. So now, it's blood." That Sunday, there were stories in the papers about blood donations increasing nationally by 10%. But we didn't realize just how huge the thing had become until Picker held his first and only Connecticut rally in the Yale Bowl that night. More than 20,000 people turned out, and some enterprising soul, unaffiliated with the Picker campaign, according to the next day's stories, set up booths outside all the entrances to the stadium, selling a variety of blood artifacts. Drop of blood, lapel pins, bumper stickers, posters with a picture of a smiling Freddie Picker, lying down on a cot, sleeve rolled up, giving blood. A logo had suddenly materialized, Picker, with the eye in the shape of a drop of blood. Picker spoke from a bare stage that night, none of the usual political trappings, just an American flag. He had most of the leadership of the Connecticut Democratic Party up there with him. He was introduced by Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and he just stood there, frozen, frightened, it seemed, as the crowd went berserk. Richard, Daisy, Lucille, and I watched it on C-SPAN. Stanton was off in Brooklyn, meeting with the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
"Who the fuck did this schedule?" Richard moaned. "We about to get our butts kicked all over Connecticut, and Jack's off in a different state sucking up to some medieval Jew."
"You have to meet with the Lubavitcher Rebbe when you do New York," Lucille said.
"You have to meet with him the Sunday before the Connecticut primary?"
It's when he said to come, Lucille sniffed. So we run on his schedule? We run on that fuckball Richard Rucker schedule?
Richard was screaming, red in the face.
Who the fuck is running for president here? This is the stupidest goddamn thing.
Jemmons, I've just about had it with you, Lucille said.
Shut up, everybody, please,
Daisy said. The candidate was about to speak. Okay, I'm sorry, Richard said, recoiling a bit from the echo, adjusting the microphone. He was wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and a striped tie. He looked like a politician, but his body language was strange, different, diffident. This is kind of overwhelming.
We love you, Freddy,
a girl shouted. You hardly know me, he said. I don't know. I don't want you to, lose perspective. I'm kind of nervous up here.
The crowd exploded. People were waving handmade placards with large painted drops of blood.
Picker pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his brow. He really did seem nervous.
It's weird, Henri, Richard said. He seemed much more comfortable in front of a crowd when I saw him in Florida. But I guess it's different when you're the man.
Now there's a candidate for your mother, I whispered to Daisy. Humble, apolitical, Paul Newman likes him, and no 30-second spots. But Daisy was transfixed. Picker seemed to be struggling. He didn't know what to say next. I didn't expect this, he said. And, all you folks giving blood in the tents out back, I want to thank you.
The crowd erupted again. It was deafening.
Look, Picker said uneasily. Could you do me a favor and not cheer so loud? There was laughter. No, he said. I really mean it. I really want everyone to calm down. I guess I mean everyone. I guess I mean the press and the TV folks and my colleagues and the folks who make a living advising my colleagues. I think we all need to calm down.
And the crowd calmed down.
This is really a terrific country, but we get a little crazy sometimes, he continued. I guess the craziness is part of what makes us great. It's part of our freedom. But we have to watch out. We have to be careful about it. There's no guarantee we'll be able to continue this high wire act, this democracy, if we don't calm down. It all may just spin out of control. I mean, the world keeps getting more complicated, and we keep having to explain it to you in simpler terms, so we can get our little oversimplified explanations on the evening news. Eventually, instead of trying to explain it, we just give up and sling mud at each other. And it's a show. It keeps you watching. Like you watching a car wreck or maybe wrestling. He stopped. He liked what he just said. That's right. The kind of posturing and hair pulling you see us do in 30-second advertisements and on podiums like this one is exactly like professional wrestling. It's fake. It's staged. It doesn't mean anything. Most of us don't hate our opponents. Hell, we don't even know them. We don't have the fierce kind of ideological differences we used to have back when the war in Vietnam was on. We just put on the show because we don't know what else to do. We don't know any other way to get you all riled up, to get you out to vote. But there are some serious things we have to talk about now. There are some decisions we have to make as a people, together. And it's gonna be hard to make them if we don't slow this thing down a little. Calm it down. Have a conversation amongst ourselves. He paused. I guess, you know, it's funny, I never even thought of it at the time, he said. But I guess that's why I decided to start this thing by giving blood. There were cheers from the crowd. He tamped them down. You can't do much else but be calm when you give blood. You just lie there and you think, or listen to music, or to a book on tape. You don't feel like spouting off all that much. And all the while, you're giving something. Not a lot, just a pint. But if each of us turned around and thought in those terms, thought about giving a little instead of worrying about what we want to get or what the government is taking from us, if we thought about it in those terms,
we'd all just naturally sort of calm down, don't you think? And I guess that's what I want to do with this campaign, sort of calm things down a little, and see if we can start having a conversation about the sort of place we want America to be in the next century. I want Governor Stanton to know I welcome him into the conversation, and the president too, matter of fact, if he has the time. But that's what I... He stopped, distracted for a moment. He looked down at the podium, looked up again. Yeah, that's all I want to do. And, okay, that's about all I have to say now. There was applause then, sustained and rolling applause, but no wild cheering, no craziness. He had tamed them. He had tamed us. We just stood around the television set, watching. Finally, Richard said the obvious. We are in seriously deep shit now. Deeper than we could begin to imagine. If Freddie Picker seemed to be campaigning for Mount Olympus, all cool and breezy and high-minded, we were neck deep in the Aegean stalls. Nothing went right that week. Tuesday was especially juicy. We were clobbered in the Connecticut primary, and the New York Post headline was, Stanton's Black Love Child. I had spent the past month dreading that headline, but now that it was here, it seemed almost superfluous. It seemed the nail after the final nail in our coffin. We were already feeling dead and buried by Freddie Picker. It wasn't much of a story, in any case. There wasn't much in the way of facts beyond the stuff Melville Jones had put on his trashy TV show. And the governor denied paternity vehemently, but his denials didn't count for anything anymore. And the fact that Fat Willie had vanished was not useful. We spent that morning debating whether to admit that a blood test was in the works, that the governor had volunteered to have his blood taken, and decided finally that it was best to keep quiet. Any admission of involvement would imply complicity, and the blood contrast with Picker would be devastating. And the fact that we were even debating such a thing implied our utter hopelessness. In the New York press, his paternity was a fact. Stanton was stunned. He was barely communicating. He sleepwalked through Howard's stupid schedule. The most rudimentary acts of politics, walking into an event through the inevitable mob of cameras and screechers, became a near unendurable agony, each movement demanding total discipline and tremendous exertion. The traditional New York politics of reflex and obligation had become twisted, distended, a forum for lunacy. Our obligatory scripted concessions weren't greeted with the usual mopey, self-righteous acquiescence, but with a fury. The blacks, the Jews, the Irish, no one was happy. All New York seemed off the edge, in the throes of some primordial catharsis. On Tuesday, after the McAllister story broke, the first feminists, dressed as pigs, began to appear. They waved oink oink placards. They made pig noises. On Tuesday night, after Stanton graciously conceded Connecticut to Harris Picker, he went to a downtown disco for a women's political caucus benefit and could not speak because a group of gay radicals stood in the middle of the dance floor chanting, "Bugger, bugger, 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 bugger." It was an odd protest. It seemed to have nothing to do with Jack Stanton. It was just a howling. A woman, a Broadway star I didn't recognize, wearing a slinky sequin dress, tried to calm the crowd and eventually succeeded by reminding them of Freddie Picker's plea for civility. Then Jack Stanton took the microphone and stared at the floor for a moment. "If all I knew about me was what you've been reading," he said, addressing the demonstrators, "I'd be out there booing too. And if I were living, as many of you are, under a death sentence, and if I felt that no one cared, that no one was trying to help me..." "Stanton, you're a phony!" shouted a young, very proper-looking woman with long jet-black hair. She was wearing a satin emerald ball gown, and the anger distorted her face, reddened it beneath her makeup. She seemed to double over, trying to push every last bit of air out of her lungs. "You're a pederast! You're a sick, hetero fuck!" Stanton took an involuntary half-step backward, raised both his arms in what seemed to be shock, as if he had been slashed across the chest. He appeared to crumple.
"I can't even begin to deal with that,"
he said softly. Afterward, the governor sat in the back of the van next to me. The seat next to the driver had been abdicated. We drove uptown along desolate avenues.
Henry, he finally whispered, putting his big hand on my shoulder. I don't know how much more of this I can take.
But he kept on taking it. He took it on morning drive time radio shows. He took it in the tabloids. He took it on the streets, where it seemed every third New Yorker had something awful to screech at him. We finally tossed Howard's schedule and went back to what felt comfortable, stopping in senior centers and schools and supermarkets, just chatting with folks. Even that proved controversial. At a senior center in Brighton Beach, an old woman suddenly burst into tears. She had just found out her daughter was dying of cancer. And Stanton hugged her and began to sing, "You'll Never Walk Alone." It was a strange, corny, but absolutely legitimate moment, the first time, so far as I knew, he had sung publicly during the presidential campaign. There wasn't a dry eye in the room, but the Daily News headline next day was, "The Singing Sinner." And that night, Jay Leno came out and said, "You see the Jack Stanton sang in Brooklyn yesterday? No, it was not Rockabye Baby." We endured what seemed a month of abuse, although it must have only been a few days. Toward the end of that week, I walked into the Stanton suite and found the governor and Susan huddled together on the couch holding hands, deep in conversation with a balding, middle-aged man who looked like an Israeli army officer, perhaps because he was wearing a khaki shirt with epaulets. He was eating half a cantaloupe, filled with a great ball of cottage cheese, flecks of which dotted his chin.
"Henry," the governor said, "this is David Adler. David, this is Henry Burton."
We nodded at each other warily.
"Henry, we're trying to figure out some way to turn this thing around," Stanton said. "David's got some good ideas, I think." "I wouldn't go overboard," Adler said. "You're running against a tidal wave. Chances are you're fucked. I was just saying to David, maybe we could do some more ads, positive ads. Folks from down home, folks who know me, telling what Jack Stanton is really like."
"Henry, you're a New Yorker?"
Adler said, finally wiping his chin.
"Henry, you think New Yorkers are going to give a rat's ass what some yokel says about anything? Governor, I've got to tell you, hee-haw never made it here. You got to use your canoodle, Governor. You got to think, what have I got that'll work in the apple? One thing you got, you're good with the folks. I don't give a shit what Leno said. I liked you crooning to that old lady. It was schmaltzy, but it was real. So I figure, the only thing you can do is get down where the folks live."
"We've been trying that," Susan said.
"No, I mean on TV, Adler said. "They watch these trashy shows. They watch Oprah and Crapola. You do your thing on that. They'll be watching. It'll get through."
"It'll just be trash," Susan said. "They'll just go after him on the trash."
"Yeah, sure," Adler said, getting up from the table now, beginning to pace. He was a fireplug with thick, muscular shoulders and forearms. "It'll be all about trash at first, but if he can't handle that, he ain't going anywhere in this thing anyway, right, Governor? You don't have much of a shot talking to them about the national debt if they think you're a... whatever."
"Jack, don't," Susan pleaded. "A president doesn't do that sort of thing. We've got to think about keeping whatever dignity we have left."
"Excuse me, ma'am," Adler said, "but who knows what the fuck a president does these days?"
It was very crude. Susan, for once, was taken aback. Our eyes met. I communicated, "Do we really need this asshole?" She communicated, "Who knows? We're desperate. Jack's casting about. Let's see." "Couldn't we start with something a little bit softer?" she asked.
"Well, I know Regis Philbin from the old country," Adler was saying. "He probably owes me a favor."
And then I had an idea. We've been treating Freddie Picker as if he were involved in some different campaign than this one. "But Governor, he said the other night he wanted to start a conversation. Why don't you invite him to come on the show with you?"
"Why would Picker do it?" Adler said. "He could only lose. He's smart. He'll say, 'Yeah, sure. I want a conversation.
and then work us on the details until Tisha B'Av.
You may be right, but I've got a feeling he'll do it, Stanton said. Did you see him the other night? He's not into playing games. And even if he does fuck around with us on this, at least we'll have him on the defensive. Henry, what is it, Thursday? Friday? Why'd it take us all week to think of this?
Because, I said, it's difficult to think straight when you're getting the shit kicked out of you. I was watching the 6 o'clock news in my room when Daisy came. She banged hard on the door. When I answered it, she took 2 steps into the room and just stood there, furious. You couldn't tell me I was fired? She said. You couldn't fucking pick up the phone? Wait a minute, I said. Fired? I didn't know that. You knew about David Adler. You had to. Yeah, but what's that? I hadn't even thought about the impact Adler might have on Daisy. They sent Ferguson, the assassin. He said they were going to make some adjustments. They were going to split the media job. Adler was going to do the positive spin. I was going to do the comparative, I think he called it. Well, that's not getting fired, I said. We were still standing in the short hall just outside the door to my bathroom, facing each other. But it's not too terrific, either. Not too terrific, she said. Henry, what do you think the chances are that we'll run another fucking negative ad in this campaign? And don't you think it's kind of insulting that they think I can only do negative? And what am I going to do now? Go back to Washington, work congressional races for Arlen, or maybe get fired by him, too? He won't fire you, I said. Right. He's too much of a fucking liberal to fire a woman. But he won't make my life particularly pleasant or profitable, either. I'll get all the hard cases. I'll have a great fucking batting average. The word will go forth. Hire Daisy and die. Look, this isn't exactly a hot campaign right now, I said. How much of a future you think any of us have here? How did you leave it with Howard? I told him to get fucked and walked out. You did? What would you have done?
I don't know, I said. I guess I would have just taken what they offered and figured that after the Adler phase passed, I'd be back or the whole thing would be in the toilet.
The Adler phase is the toilet, she spat. I can't fucking believe you. Why don't you fight for me? He's gonna do positive spin? What can he do that I couldn't do?
I didn't know he was going to do positive.
And if you had known?
Well, positive isn't easy, I said.
Henry, what the fuck does that mean? Did you see my positives? The ones down in Florida, the ones we didn't use?
Yes.
And?
They were okay.
Henry!
She swung at me then. But she wasn't as good at slapping as Susan, and the blow landed harmlessly, half on my arm and half on my chest. She came at me, to be hugged, I realized 1 second too late. Reflexively, I put out my hands and caught her by the biceps and held her at arm's length. She looked at me, stunned. She looked in my eyes and saw, what? Not enough.
Oh, shit, Henry, she said, shaking herself free of my grasp. Wiping her eyes. God damn you.
Daisy. I tried to hug her now, but she pushed me away.
Henry, you are one cold son of a bitch, she said, and was gone.
I stood there for a moment, then turned and looked at my hotel room. I went to the window, pulled the drapes for the first time in a week, and looked out. A modern office building directly across from me. Men in shirt sleeves sitting in offices, well-dressed women moving between offices, potted plants. I went to look for Daisy. I knocked on her door, no answer. I went to the headquarters suite. No one had seen her. I went down to the lobby and found Richard, checking out.
I'm not quitting, he said. I'm just taking a little leave of absence.
Richard, I said. I felt woozy. Wait, come here. I pulled in from the checkout line, over to a quiet corner of the lobby.
You can't bail now. I'm not bailing completely, he said. I'm just going to work out of Washington for a time. Scorps call me. I'll talk strategy and bullshit. Just like always, tell them how Picker's the flavor of the week and Jack will be back.
like he always is. Jack or Susan call, I'll talk strategy and bullshit with them too. But I ain't sticking around here right now. I ain't taking no marching orders from that fucking mesomorph. You know what I mean? Fucking guy says to me, I do 200 sit-ups a day. How many you do? So I look at him and I say, 201. You know what I mean? Me and David Adler come from different parts of the jungle. So Henri, let him have his fucking day. This thing's about gone anyway. There wasn't much I could say to that. Henri, look, man. I've been through this shit 100 times, Richard said. That's what these guys do. They love you, they stop loving you. They say, I'm paying this guy $10,000 a month and he ain't made me God yet, so fuck him. But this was different, wasn't it? I asked. Richard laughed. Different doesn't even begin to describe it, he said, then softened. Yeah, Henri, it was different. It was worth it. But you know, I'm always relieved to be getting home. Much as I like room service, I'm scared shitless on the road, especially when a campaign starts going sour and you have time to think. You know what I mean? I'm always afraid I'll keel over and die in some hotel room, alone in my underpants, working for some stranger who can't give a speech to save his fucking life. This shit we do is a lot of fun, but ultimately, it sucks. Au revoir, Henri. C'est la vie, say the old folks. It goes to show you can never tell, I replied, completing the Chuck Berry lyric. You're okay, my man, Richard said. Take care, your ass. I lay flat on my back, fully clothed, paralyzed, staring at the ceiling. I couldn't believe it. The assholes had staged a coup. No, they hadn't even staged it. They had fallen into it. Richard and Daisy were gone. Howard and Lucille were still around, but they always would be. And now David Adler would be calling the strategic shots. I could not imagine being part of that campaign. I could not imagine getting off the bed. I would die alone in a hotel room 60 blocks from my actual home, which I didn't have the courage to live in. But at least I would not die in my underwear. I lacked the energy to take off my clothes. Susan came late that night. She knocked on the door. I let her in. She walked past me into the room, turned the desk chair toward the bed, and sat down on it. You okay? She asked. No, I said. I know, she said. She didn't say anything for a long while. She was wearing a charcoal gray suit. She had just come in from some event, I realized. Things are happening, and I just can't believe they're happening to us, that they're real, she said. You read the paper, you see Jack's name, you see my name, and you can't believe the people they are talking about, saying these things about, are anyone you know, much less us. Henry, you know us. This is not what we're about. History, I said, is what we're about. Her eyes filled with tears, but she held them in place. I know you must be hurting, she said. I know it's a difficult moment with Daisy and Richard going. I didn't want them to go. You've got to believe that. And the governor? He thinks Adler may help in New York. I'm like you, not so sure about that, but Lord knows we need help. She said this almost airily, sarcastically, but she caught herself and began again more quietly and seriously. Henry, we need help, and I have to ask you a personal favor. Please, do not leave us now. I don't know if we could survive it. Daisy, Richard, that's bad enough. But if you were to go, the impact on everyone, the staff, the muffins, would be devastating. The impact on Jack would be unimaginable. And you know how I feel about you, she said, staring at me evenly. How's that? I asked, taking a leap into uncharted territory. You know, I've kind of been curious about it since that night in Chicago. I mean, what was that all about? It didn't seem to have all that much to do with me. Was it that you were feeling lonely, needy? Or were you just trying to play catch-up with the governor, after Emily McAllister told you about Loretta.
Henry, she said, that is just too cruel.
Then she softened a bit. But I guess I deserve it. It was wrong. I was needy. I wasn't thinking.
Me neither. I was just reacting.
I remember the way she'd left that night, gathering her clothes, slipping through the slant of anti-crime light, the rift in my curtain. I realized that I hadn't felt any residual titillation since. That was odd. Susan Stanton was not unattractive. The forbidden nature of the event had been extremely provocative, but I hadn't allowed myself to be aroused by it. It had been service, not sex, a strangely humiliating service, part of my disgraceful role in the McAllister business. Now, however, watching her perform in my room as Susan Stanton, watching her struggle for something more intimate and emotionally compelling than Susan Stantonhood, I suddenly remembered her tongue, her hands moving on me, and I found myself growing excited. Henry, she began again, oblivious to my arousal, Jack loves you. He needs you now, not as his deputy campaign manager, but as a friend, a member of the family. There aren't many people he can trust. He trusts you. Please don't leave him, not now, not like this. Stay with us for a little while, until we have a better sense of how this is going to resolve itself. It may not, she said, her voice catching now. Be very long. But please, don't cut us loose. All right, I said without nearly enough hesitation, reacting to her emotion, surprising myself. She rose, gave me a peck on the forehead, and left. I thought about this afterward. I thought about loyalty. It was the ultimate attribute of the perfect servant. And I was nothing if not loyal to my employers. I was more loyal to the Stantons than I'd been to Daisy. I had sat there considering all the angles while David Adler made his pitch, all the consequences for Jack Stanton and the campaign, but I hadn't given a moment's thought to the impact it might have on Daisy. It hadn't even crossed my mind, and she knew that. Of course, I could never have stopped Stanton from hiring the asshole, but I could have said, what does Daisy think about all this? I could have at least said that. I could have thought of her. If she and I were involved in something deeper than a campaign romance, shouldn't I have thought of her? And if we weren't involved in something deeper than a campaign romance, what sort of game had I been playing? What sort of stunted creature was I? I looked in the mirror and saw the butler. I was, Susan had said, practically a member of the family, which was the most banal compliment one can pay a menial. Then again, she hadn't said practically. She hadn't qualified it at all. And then, as I built up a doleful, self-pitying head of steam, I realized there was another, rather delicious, complicating factor here. Luther wasn't right either. He had assumed my servility was a slavery atavism, a consequence of self-hatred, the absence of pride, a black thing. He had half convinced me of that, but all the qualities that made me good at what I did had come from the other side, from Mother. The calm and patience and acceptance and the loyalty, those were her things. The Burton blood, the Revs and Fathers, was too proud and angry to put up with walking half a step behind any candidate. Perfect staff position, ready to serve. My most comfortable place in life. I laughed out loud. It was just too hilarious. I was a genius at servitude because I was half white. Actually, David Adler did a very good thing. He got us Geraldo. Without Geraldo. Actually, Geraldo did a very good thing by agreeing to the format. Freddie Picker immediately accepted without conditions. It would be the one debate of the New York primary. And, of course, it became an impossibly silly media circus. There were more than 250 requests for credentials. CNN had more people there than either campaign did. Who's doing spin for us? Lorene asked. No one, so far as I know, I said. Well, CNN wants someone for after the show. You do it, I said. But I'll tell you what, no bullshit. When they ask how we think we did, either speak for yourself and tell the truth, or tell them we'll let the debate speak for itself. In fact, I'd kind of prefer the latter. Are you speaking for David Adler? Probably not, I said. But I have a revised contract with the campaign. I only do what I can live with. So maybe I should ask him, she said. Suit yourself. Come on, Henry, get the fuck off it, Lorraine said. I'm just a working girl. This isn't an adventure, it's a job. I'm telling you, as deputy campaign manager, I think we should let the debate speak for itself. I'll take the fall for this, if there's a fall to be taken. As it happened, the Pickerites came with even fewer staff people than we did. A crisp-looking young blonde named Mara Donahue approached me in the hallway outside the studio and introduced herself. How are you guys handling CNN? She asked. We're not, I said. I instructed our press secretary to say the debate spoke for itself. Of course, David Adler works his own side of the street. He could declare war on Syria. She laughed. But you're not going on? None of the regulars? I nodded. Good, she said. That's what we've been doing. I've noticed, I said. We're learning from you. Who's we, by the way? Show me your army. There's me, and that's Terry Fisk over there, she said, pointing to a stocky black guy carrying a sheaf of papers. He does schedule, I do all else. We also got the two picker boys along. Serious studs, and I mean serious. And you get away with it? No, we're a mess, she said. But the candidate won't let it be a zoo. He's zoophobic or something. He's big into the calm thing. No entourage, no traveling press.
No press?
We just tell them where we're going to be, you know, put the schedule out on AP, and let them find their own way.
Where did you come from? Harris?
Yeah, Terry too, but not very prominently. The governor told all the consultant types to go home. He kept the issues shop, interviewed some of the Smurfs, and here we are.
And there we were.
Freddie Picker came out of a doorway, nodded at me. I was, probably, someone vaguely recognizable to him, and headed down toward the studio. He was not a small man, but he seemed less substantial, stooped, and sort of dour compared with Stanton. He seemed a little lost, too, out of place in the forced cheeriness of the Geraldo set. He was quiet. He wasn't a blabber. He and Stanton sat, just the two of them, at a small round table in front of a live audience. They each had coffee mugs. Stanton drank Diet Coke, Picker, iced tea. Geraldo was supposed to open the show, ask the first question, and then it would be all theirs, no ground rules. I sat in the control room with Susan and the two Picker boys. They were tall, handsome, Hispanic, and polite. They shook hands and didn't attempt any small talk. They sat down at the other end of the row of seats behind the director and his staff.
Well, okay, Geraldo said when the bright lights came on. You gentlemen know the rules. No chair tossing, no claw holds. Free falls, I come in to stop the bout.
Stanton smiled and nodded. Picker simply nodded. Stanton seemed more comfortable, more presidential, sitting there. And I will now ask the first question, to you, Governor Stanton. We have heard reports this week that you may be the father of a child by a teenage girl in your hometown of Mammoth Falls. You have denied this, but the girl and her family have disappeared. What on earth is going on?
Well, Geraldo, first let me thank you for making this forum possible, and I do hope we eventually get around to discussing matters of substance. But I will answer your question. The family involved are good people, friends of mine. I spoke with the father just before he took them to their undisclosed location to see if there was anything I could do to help. He apologized to me for causing so much trouble. He said he was taking his family away because of all the craziness. His daughter couldn't get any peace. He couldn't even operate his business. He said he wanted to wait till it all simmered down. And I'd like to make this plea. When these good people do return home and start their lives again, I'd hope the media would give them some peace. Governor Picker has spoken eloquently to this point. We do need to all calm down. We've got important public business to deal with, and unless, Fred, you've got something to add,
he said, nodding toward Picker, who nodded back no. I'd like to move on and ask you a question. I know you supported Senator Harris and that you've come up with a modified version of his virgin uses fee. Not virgin uses, but sort of, Picker said. Whatever, Stanton replied. Have you given much thought to how that's going to affect the working people of America? Even if you do a small energy tax of some sort? How do we work it so they don't get whopped? I haven't worked out the details, Picker said. You know, you negotiate most of this stuff out with the Congress.
Right.
And it's absolutely appropriate that you remind the folks that the sort of things we propose in these campaigns are best-case scenarios and always subject to negotiation, Stanton said. In fact, there are times when our own ideas are subject to change during a campaign. There was laughter. The director cut away to Geraldo, standing off to the side, chuckling. But this was now Jack Stanton's show. Let me give you an example. Early on, I proposed a middle-class tax cut. Senator Harris disagreed with that, and looking back, I think he was probably right. I've been thinking about this, and Governor Picker, I'd like to get your feelings about it. But maybe we should do something more targeted. Say we do a combination of your idea and mine. We do an energy tax of some sort and give a rebate to average folks. Say incomes of $50,000 or less, maybe an increased tax deduction for each member of their family. Picker thought for a moment. The politic thing would have been to ignore the proposal or brush it aside, find some way to take control of the show. But Picker said, I would think you'd have to consider something like that, although, as I said, I'm not sure about the details. Wouldn't you be favoring the folks who had more children?
Yeah, I guess, Stanton said, amazed that Picker had just, in effect, bought his proposal.
We could have a deduction per family cutoff, if you like.
But can you bottom line that? Picker asked.
What would the net revenue gain be? We do need to reduce the deficit.
This was truly bizarre. Picker was ignoring the audience and having a policy discussion with Jack Stanton. He didn't seem to care about the politics or television of it all. Stanton was thrilled to go along. He was, in fact, ecstatic.
You're right. We do need to reduce the deficit, but when we bring it down, we can't take it out of average folks' hide, he said. There are ways we can spend money more efficiently, ways we can spend less, but I think, ultimately, if you want to reduce the deficit, we're going to have to raise taxes on the rich. Are you with me on that one?
Depends on how you define rich, Picker said. But, yeah.
Senator Harris, wanted to cut capital gains, Stanton said. You for that, too?
And so it went. Eventually, Geraldo, amazed that his hot ticket had turned into a meeting of the Senate Finance Committee, jumped in and said, Hey, guys, you mind if we get some questions from the audience? A middle-aged woman stood and said, I'm a teacher. We're on the front lines every day. Governor Picker, what would you do to help us do our job?
Well, education is very important, Picker said. It's the most important thing. The federal government helps with student loans and with extra money for poorer districts, and we should continue that, but I guess, Jack, education's mostly a state and local thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But the president has the bully pulpit, Stanton said.
He seemed much more sure of himself than Picker.
He can go around the country and show what works. We can also, Fred, you forgot to mention, boost funds for Head Start. Picker nodded. But ultimately, ma'am, he continued, I've got to say that you're right. You are on the front lines every day. I think an inspired teacher is more important than anything an old politician or bureaucrat can do.
And Jack Stanton looked into the camera, raised an eyebrow, and quickly winked at Susan. She inhaled sharply and grabbed hold of my wrist.
And so I think we should keep experimenting with programs that liberate teachers to be as creative as they want to be.
Jack's absolutely right about that, Picker now jumped in, enthused. I sent my boys to a magnet school. I was willing to put them on a bus, send them into Tallahassee. We live on a farm just outside of town. I did that because they had a special math program for my older boy and a string program for my younger son, who is a pretty damn fine fiddler.
Philippe doesn't like it when I say that. He plays the viola. But you're right, Jack, about education. You walk into a school that works, you can feel it immediately. If we could only get the people, the teachers and the parents especially, more excited and involved in the schools...
Trouble is, it's tough for the families where both mom and dad work, Stanton said. They were just chatting now. They don't have time for PTA and all the rest like some of us do.
Stanton stopped, and in a tone of voice that mocked himself, mocked all politicians,
that's why I favor the family tax credit.
Okay, okay, Picker said, laughing. More questions? Geraldo asked. There are questions about Social Security, foreign aid, taxes again, and no great disagreements. Finally, an elderly black gentleman slowly pulled himself to his feet.
I think a lot of us are sick of all the bullshit and politics, he said. There were oohs and cheers. And while I can't follow all of what you fellas are talking about, I've been sitting here listening to you, and it sure sounds a lot different from the usual. Even I can see you ain't trying to rip each other apart. Maybe you're even trying to work things out a little.
He paused. Excuse me, sir, but do you have a question? Geraldo asked.
Yeah, I guess it's this, the old man said. Any way we can get you both?
Susan, tears streaming, was out of the control room like a shot when it was over. I was right behind her. The audience had come down to the table. Stanton, Picker, and Geraldo were shaking hands with the folks. Susan and I stood off to the side in the doorway. David Adler suddenly appeared, looking for congratulations. Thanks, David, Susan said. Really?
He dominated, Adler said.
Finally, Jack and Picker began moving toward the hallway, Geraldo tagging along. Stanton thanked the host and said,
Geraldo, you think Freddie and I could have a moment?
Sure, he said. You want a room?
No, here's fine.
He leaned down into Picker, draped an arm over his shoulder.
Freddie, I just want you to know how much I admire the way you're running this campaign. It's good for the party, it's good for the country, and I expect it'll pay off for you. And thanks for giving me a chance to regain a little of what I lost.
No problem. And thank you too, Jack. Picker put an arm around Stanton's back. You sure do know every little nook and cranny of this policy stuff.
I'm gonna have to study up.
Jack?
What?
Nothing, Picker said. Thanks.
I remember days like this one. Vaguely, but I remember,
Stanton said in the van heading downtown.
When was it? When did this used to be fun, Henry?
New Hampshire, I said. Last year. But this was good. You think it'll have any impact?
No, Stanton said. No one was watching. No one cares. I mean, who gives a rat's ass that I knew more about the fucking budget than he does? Hell, if I didn't know me, I'd probably vote for him. But it's weird. It's like he's been transformed. Different guy from when he was governor. I never saw anything like it. It's like he's not... like he never was a politician. He doesn't have the instincts anymore. The little things we do to cut in on each other. You saw that, right? He isn't playing the game at all. Not in any way. It's absolutely strange.
Stanton laughed, and then seemed to have a thought.
Henry, you know what? He's not going to be able to sustain it. It's a great concept, but it's too radical. The stuff we do, the craft of it, has developed very slowly and logically over time. You ever think about the fact that the risks we do started with George Washington? Andrew Jackson massaged it some, and Lincoln, and then Boss Murphy here in New York, and FDR, Bilbo, and George Wallace in the South, all of them, the giants and the shitheels, have massaged it, moved it, pushed it ahead. He stared out the window at the vibrant chaos of New York. And Fred is doing that too. He's moving it in a way that's probably appropriate for these fucked up times. The game got too ornate and bullshitty, that's for sure. And he's a corrective. But you don't wrench the art of politics away from its roots so drastically without paying some sort of price. All the bullshit we do is there for a reason.
Fuck with it too much, and it'll come back and bite your ass.
Stanton turned around and pounded his fist on his knee. Henry, he said, there may be some life in this thing yet.